Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This episode of Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline.ag. We might be headed into the dog days of summer, but there isn't anything lazy about this summer's sports action with Major League Baseball and the UFC hotter than ever. Get in the mix at BetOnline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I'm coming to you from the Broken Skull Ranch out here in Nevada. Just flew in today, got in my Chevy pickup truck and started riding around running errands, and man, we are having a really good time. Just recently, I returned from the Monday Night Raw reunion WWE put on down there in Tampa, Florida. And I'll tell you what, man, it was an absolute blast. I think Lillian Garcia might come by the house, and we're going to cover just talking about the reunion and all the scuttlebutt and all the hugs and smiles and conversations we had and kind of relive that event. So I won't go into details about that now, but man, I had an absolute blast. As a matter of fact, I believe I have a phone call coming up with Ric Flair coming up pretty quick, and we'll also talk about that reunion. But anyway, here's what happened. I got invited to go down to Tampa and be a part of that Monday Night Raw reunion. So, since I was going to go down to Tampa, I'd been in conversations with Hulk Hogan about doing my podcast a few weeks before. Well, this was a great opportunity to go down there, let WWE fly me down there because it was going to be on their dime because they were going to get me to Monday Night Raw. So, I went down to Tampa early, several days early, and hung out damn near all day with Hulk Hogan on Saturday afternoon. I went to his house, checked everything out. We had some conversations, some kayfabe stuff, just shooting a breeze. And we went over to another location. He had a place on the water. And we went over there and just shot the breeze for about an hour and a half or two and just shut the microphones down. I had a beer, and we just talked about everything under the sun. And then he was going to take me back to the hotel, and he said, "Hey, man, are you hungry?" I said, "Yeah, man, I am." He goes, "Do you like sushi?" I said, "You're damn right I do. I love sushi." So we got in his Dodge Challenger. God dang, that is a hot-ass car. I think it has 797 horsepower. And, man, I tell you what, Hulk or Terry launched into it a couple of times. That car will run its ass off. We zipped over and we ate some sushi, and it was some of the best sushi I've ever had. So he's got a great little hookup over there. He's got a great little spot. I don't remember the name of it, and I wouldn't tell you because I'm not going to give away his location. And just had a good time together, man. He dropped me off at my hotel, and I had a real good time talking to Hulk Hogan, Terry Bollea. And I tell you, I don't know where anybody has anybody. I don't build Mount Rushmores myself. That's just not my thing. That's for other people to do, or I guess it's like a fantasy type thing. But if there ever was going to be a Mount Rushmore, you damn sure bet Hulk Hogan's face, head, whatever you want to say, bust would be on the Mount Rushmore. If you go back to the different eras or the different regions from back in the day, I don't know cash register stuff. I should have probably called Dave Meltzer or someone like that who was kind of a be-all, end-all of all wrestling information. But Hulk Hogan is one of the biggest box office attractions of all time. Probably the most well-known professional wrestler that's ever lived. Probably the most popular. Andre's up there. Bruno's up there. Ric Flair's up there. Taker's. I mean, I'm not going to list everybody that's up there. But, man, everybody knows who Hulk Hogan is. Back in my competitive days in 94 when he came down to WCW, and we're going to get into conversation about that, I wasn't real happy about that, and you'll hear about why on the podcast. And being very competitive while he was doing his thing and I was doing my thing, and he had the big run in WWF way back in the day, and I was down there struggling in WCW, and then they came in, and then I went to WWE, and then he came back up to WWE. There's an interesting conversation. I think we covered on the podcast briefly why we never worked together, and he always wanted to. In the back of my mind, I wanted to, but for some reason, it just didn't sit right with me. I don't know what it was, and we'll cover that in the podcast. But I got nothing but respect for the guy, and I think it was kind of assumed that there was heat between myself and Hulk Hogan. And I remember calling him up on the telephone a couple of years ago, and I said, hey, man, I said, I don't know for what reason it is, but for some reason, people perceive there as being heat between you and I. I said, man, I was very competitive during my in-ring days, but I got nothing but respect for you and everything you did in the business of pro wrestling, man. And we straightened all that up on a telephone call. And then all these years later, ended up down there in Clearwater, Florida, at his crib, and shot the breeze just talking about a podcast. And you can't cover Hulk Hogan's career in an hour and a half podcast, much less a 2 or 3 hour podcast. So, man, we casually shoot the breeze in this podcast and talk about a few things. And he tells some great stories that I really enjoyed. I look forward to having another conversation with Terry Hulk Hogan the next time I see him, and we'll continue because we'll talk about that whole NWO run. We'll talk about the whole Hollywood Hogan thing, that and much more. But this podcast, I hope you enjoy it for what it is. It's, I hate to brag about myself, but it's two of the biggest names in the history of the business with a couple of microphones in their hand at Terry's house shooting the breeze. And I'm drinking some light beer, or whatever they call them. I think they're called Trulies. But I enjoyed talking with Hulk Hogan, Terry Bollea, the man. And I hope you enjoy this podcast. Without any further ado, here's my conversation with one of the greatest box office attractions, greatest performers, and a guy who really knew how to connect with an audience, almost like no other. Here's my conversation with Hulk Hogan. Boys, the summer are going nonstop. It's a race to the top, and Major League Baseball is blazing hot with no signs of stopping. The Yankees, Twins, and Astros are all leading the pack in the American League. Over in the National League, it's the Dodgers, Cubs, and Braves standing tall. But keep your eyes on the Cardinals, Indians, and Athletics, all on the come up. There's only one place that has you covered and one place we trust, betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use the promo code podcast1 or text BET NOW to 238-669 to receive a 50% welcome bonus. That's betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partners of Podcast One Sportsnet. Before we get to my conversation with Hulk Hogan, don't forget, I got a brand new show called Straight Up Steve Austin, season premiere August 12th on USA Network right after Monday Night Raw. In this series, there are 7 episodes. I shoot the breeze with celebrity guests. We do some activities. We raise hell. We have some fun. I get to know them. They get to know me. We step in my world, and I'll step into some of their worlds as well. Please set your DVRs on August 12th. Straight Up Steve Austin, my new show on the USA Network. Season premiere August 12th. And that's the bottom line.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Man, I'm sitting here in Tampa, Florida, talking to the one and only Hulk Hogan. I'll call him Terry throughout the interview. Terry, thanks for having me over in your crib, man. It's good to finally talk to you because I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, but it's hard to get to Tampa from Los Angeles. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great, brother. It's good to see you here on the beach and coming on down to the calm side of the world here. My son lived in Los Angeles for the last 10 years, and I spent 23 years being out there, so I know how crazy it gets, so it's good to see you here in the calm beach area today.
Man, I started rolling, I started flying in yesterday. We got close to land, and I was like looking at the coastline. You know, back in the day, you know, obviously there was a territory here in Florida. We're going to get to that. But, you know, a lot of the guys are based out here because of that, and it's a good place to live. And part of WWF, part of WCW, we used to run here all the time, but it's been a long time since I've been here. And then, to let people know what's been going on, I've been over here hanging with Terry for about 2 hours now. We've been talking about everything under the sun that's, you know, stuff that you don't really record. So I don't know where to stop or where to start, but let's just jump into somewhere.
Sure.
And let's jump at it from this standpoint. And I got all coffeeed up, and now I'm drinking a
truly passion fruit, 5% alcohol. This kind of settled me down a little bit. I kind of needed this. Man, as I walked in, I was getting out of your car, and I kind of gimped around trying to pick up my recording bag, and I was stumbling a little bit, and you looked at me and said, "Are you all right?" I said, "Yeah, I'm all right. It just takes me a while to get going sometimes." How are you feeling after everything that you've been through? Because I have been watching probably 6 hours of your matches, read everything about you, and watched all the beatings that you took, all the legs that you dropped. Got to hang around with you filming a kayfabe project, which we can't talk about yet, but it's soon to be released. And I got a chance to hang out with you about a month ago. So after everything that you've been through, just from a physicality standpoint, where are you?
Well, I got to kind of set it up first with a woe is me story, you know, because, you know, everybody talks about the fake wrestling, you know, and all that crazy word that they always say, but you do get hurt. We all know that. So the woe is me story goes, I started having my knees scoped many years ago, right knee 4 times with a scope, left knee 4 times with a scope. And then I finally had them both replaced. Then I had both hips replaced. Then I went in for 1 back surgery and it turned into having 9 back surgeries. And I actually wrestled The Rock with a knee replacement, a hip replacement. And then when I had the other knee and hip done, I kept going. So, you know, I was still wrestling, but as soon as they cut on my back, it was game over. You know, I was hoping that if they cut on my back one time, I'd have the fusion like Shawn Michaels and I could keep going. But the doctors that wanted me to have the fusion said, try everything else first. So I went to a place called Laser Spine. They cut on me 6 times and they basically took me out of the game. They cut so much bone away and things went awry after the first 6 surgeries. And then the last 3 surgeries, after they told my new wife, Jennifer, I'd never walk again after the 6th surgery, it took me 3 more 12-hour surgeries to get up on my feet and rolling again. I was down about 1.5 years. But all that being said, I'm pretty darn cool. I can't wrestle again, but I'm really cool other than this darn arthritis is kicking in. And I'm going to be 66 years old in a week. I still work out with weights, use lightweight. But my parents, before they passed away, when they were my age, their hands were crippled up like a sideshow freak. You know, their hands were crippled and swollen and everything like that. So, you know, with the vitamins and then taking care of myself with organic food, I'm not there. But the main thing is the arthritis. I had no idea what that word really meant till you feel what it means. And boy, the arthritis is definitely something that changes the game. But I'm doing good, man. When I wake up in the morning, like when I told you I was going to meet you at 10:30, I backtrack about 3 hours because it takes me about 1.5 hours in the morning before I can stand up straight, completely straight. That's how long to get the blood flow and everything. So once I get standing up straight and I get a little momentum, I'm okay. But you know, things are good. If I could get rid of this darn arthritis, I think I'd be pretty well set. But all things considered, at my age, 66 years old, after what we've all been through, I think I'm doing pretty good.
What does your arthritis feel like? Because that's a word that I hear about all the time and that many people suffer from. So what are the actual symptoms? Because, man, I'm looking down the road and maybe facing the same thing, but I don't feel it now. So what does that feel like? Because I can imagine a hip replacement. I've had my knee issues. I've had both shoulders completely rebuilt, cervical fusion, 3 broke bones in my lower back. I mean, you know, we've got a lot of similar injuries. But what does the arthritis feel like?
It's a constant, you know, it's a constant overriding pain that makes it so you don't want to smile.
But is it in your fingers, your hands, or where is it?
Now it's everywhere. Like with my right hand, if I go to try to get the car key out of my right pocket and try to go in there with my thumb, it'll shoot a pain up the back of my head. So it's just these sharp pains that whatever this arthritis or the inflammation is, you know, it hits you pretty hard. So it's you have good days and bad days, and it depends on if it rains or if it's cold or if you drink alcohol, because that'll dehydrate your joints and everything. So it's just a series of trying to do the best you can and taking the fish oil and everything else you take, glucosamine and everything else.
I was fixing to ask you that one.
Everything else you can take just to kind of like take the edge off, but nothing makes it go away. Pain pills, nothing will make it go away.
And do you have to take pain pills?
I was for a long time. And right now I'm doing the CBD stuff, glucosamine. I'm having stem cells injected into my wrist, my shoulder, my back.
Where are you going for that? You going here in the States? You going overseas for that?
I was going down to Guatemala, but I had a Joan Rivers moment down there where they almost lost me on the table.
Dude, are you kidding me?
Yeah, yeah. I start. Well, right now I'm going to Tampa Rejuvenation Center here in Tampa. But when I first started going down to Mexico, they took the bone marrow out of my hips, spun the blood, and hit me with the stem cells the first time, and I was fine. Then they took my stem cells to L.A. and they colonized them. They grew the stem cells. And when I went back to Guadalajara, there was a 24-hour window when the doctor left L.A. I had to meet him there and have him injected within 24 hours. And as soon as they put the needle in my arm, my eyes rolled back. It felt like I had 25 elephants sitting on me. And thank God my wife was there, because nobody spoke English, but she read my eyes. I was like desperate. And they got the paddles out. All the numbers went crazy. They were getting ready to hit me with the paddles, and I was going under. And when they shut it off, we found out later that they had soaked the stem cells in DMSO so they wouldn't crystallize when they froze them. And I'm allergic to DMSO. So I had a Joan Rivers moment. If my wife hadn't have been there, you know, it would have been a different story. But since I went to Guadalajara, I went down there a couple of times after that and had a couple close calls with, I got conjunctivitis one time when I went down there because of bacteria in the water they put in my arm. So I quit going to Mexico. But now I'm going to a really good place in Tampa, and they're trying to get me up and running again.
Are you seeing any improvements from the stem cell stuff done here in Tampa?
It's the weirdest thing. I was on the phone with the doctor yesterday, and I said, when you first hit me with the stem cells, I really noticed it in my back, because when I put my left foot down when I walk, there's a crazy pain that goes up my hip, my back, into the back of my ear. Once I got the stem cells and I walked out of the office, I put my left foot down, I put weight on it, there was no pain shooting up through my head. And that lasted about 4 days, and then I was back to square one. You know, if that could last forever, I'd be good. So I told the doctor, you know, I said, this stuff doesn't last very long. You know, it's very, very expensive. It's like $8,000 to have my wrist and my shoulder and my back shot up. And they said, well, we're going to give you all these peptides, which is the healing stuff of the future. And let's just keep going with the protocol and let's see if we can get some improvement. But I notice it right out of the box, and then it wears off pretty quickly.
Hey, man, how did you find out that you were allergic to DMSO? Because way back in the day, and you can attest to this, because you're a generation ahead of me, and I'm right behind you on your heels. But you know, back in the day when you first get into business, you're getting the trash beat out of you, and all of a sudden you're subjected to a lot of things that you've never felt before. And then all of a sudden a lot of substances maybe you've not seen in vast quantities and you have access to. But one of the things that we would do back in the day to combat an injury was to grind up a couple of aspirin and then put your hand in a sandwich bag, a Ziploc bag, and put the DMSO so it didn't go through your fingers, and then you'd rub that on the injury. So the thinking was, because the DMSO penetrates the skin and takes whatever you put in there right into the injury, that's what we were doing back in the days. Guys crunching up aspirin, putting DMSO in and rubbing it into the injury. Were you doing that? Because, I mean, that would have been the first time maybe you've been exposed to DMSO. How did you find out you were allergic to it?
I never used it. Luke,
but you know the treatment I'm talking about,
oh,
though.
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah. Because Butch, one of the Bushwhackers, just his breath smelled like DMSO.
Yeah.
His whole, when he'd sweat, he smelled like DMSO. I never tried it, because back in the day then, whenever that was, 25, 30 years ago, I was eating the pain pills back then, and I wasn't to the point where I'm at now. But I never tried it. And you know, they could say it was the leg drop, or they could say maybe it was the steroids or the combination of both. But the truth was, when I finally saw my x-rays, I had scoliosis, which I never knew, like a crazy S snake in my back. And if you ever look at me doing a double bicep shot, I don't stand up straight. I always cock my hips to the right. If you ever really look at a good shot of me doing a double bicep, it's almost like I'm cocky, copping my hips, trying to look sexy or something. But that's not the case. My back wasn't straight. And I never realized that until I had my first back surgery. They go, Jesus, man, you've got this crazy scoliosis. And I had no idea. But that's kind of like where it all started. But I never used the DMSO until the stem cell thing happened.
When you first got into business, you're a big guy. Always been a big guy. But you weren't really an athlete. Played a little baseball, but you had an injury, and you were a musician. And you were a very good student. So all of a sudden, you start hitting weights, you start getting into business. And did you ever have one of the veterans, and you've always been a big guy, and so a guy like my size, man, we're taking a lot of bumps because we're going to bump more because I'm a smaller guy than you. But did some of the veterans come up to you and say, hey, kid, take it easy. You only got so many bumps left on your bump ticket. My question is, long story short, was the payoff worth it? What was all the fame, fortune, and all the good times worth? How you feel now?
Well, to answer that question first, yes.
I agree.
I wouldn't change a thing. I mean, it was a great life. It was fun. I mean, I loved the business. I mean, you know, anybody that really knows me can tell you how much I love wrestling, love this. I'm a fan. I'm a mark. I'm the biggest mark you've ever seen. I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm a mark. When you were coming over today, my wife goes, I haven't seen you this excited since we were married. I mean, I'm a huge fan. So I just love the business. But when I first started, they said real wrestlers don't wear knee pads. That was the rap I got from Hiro Matsuda when he broke me in the business. He goes, if you're a real wrestler, you don't wear knee pads. So about a year into the business, you know, trying to do 20-minute Broadways with Brian Blair and, you know, Gordon Nelson and all these crazy guys that were just bending my head around and sticking it up my ass. You know, I couldn't wrestle, and they could wrestle. You know, after about 2 years, I had to start wearing knee pads because my knees were already blown out. You know, so all those injuries that they said, kid, if you keep doing that, you know, 25, 30 years from now, you'll be sorry. It all came back to haunt me. Everything they said was true. All the stupid crap, you know, and the dumb bumps on the concrete in Japan and all the stuff with Hansen and all those idiots. I feel every bit of it today.
Man, when I watch some of your old tapes back, dude, you were pretty damn quick on your feet. And a lot of people don't remember that, maybe from some of your later matches. But, dude, you were pretty damn quick on your feet and also had some sugar holds, some shoot holds, and had some wrestling background. But is that because of the time that you spent in Japan or from your time with Gordon Nelson or some of those shooters? Because you worked a big man pro style, but when it come down to it, you could also wrestle. But that wasn't your style to technically wrestle, but you could.
Yeah, well, that was the whole thing was when I first got in the business, I lasted about 7 or 8 months. And it's just such a, here we go with the woe is me backstory. I went to school with Mike Graham. Eddie Graham was a promoter. I was like a year behind Mike Graham and Steve Kern. Steve liked me, but Mike and I really didn't get along until later in the years we became good friends.
Was that the heat because you didn't
high
play football?
High school crap. I didn't play football. I was long-haired playing music. So when Matsuda broke me in, after he broke my leg, he broke my leg, and I went home for 4 months. I was supposed to be going to college. Finance and management was my major. I had a minor in music, and I was going to be an accountant, you know, and play music, you know, on the backside to make some extra money. But I was a huge wrestling fan, so when I had enough courage to go down there, they didn't want some long-haired hippie because I had long blonde hair, full head of hair, playing in a band. Plus, the biggest mistake I made was I ran my mouth around this small town. I'm going to be a wrestler. I'm going to be a wrestler. You know, big mistake. So when I went down there, Matsuda broke my leg the first day, sat between my legs, put his elbow on my shin, grabbed my toe, posted my leg, and snapped my leg, and told me not to come back. Well, I went back 4 months later. I had my hair cut real short, and my brother was the tough guy. I wasn't, you know, and so I was always in the shadow of my older brother, who was this biker who ran around with a tough crowd. And when I got my leg broke, my dad was pissed. He goes, how dare you let anybody hurt you? What's wrong with you? You're not like your brother. And it kind of like, it lit me up, you know? And so I went back, cut my hair short, and I said, no one's ever going to hurt me again. That was my attitude. And they weren't trying to hurt me now when I came back. They couldn't believe I came back, but they were exercising me, getting me in really, really, really good shape. I went down to about 245, 50 pounds. Which is, I'm 290 old. Like right now, I'm 295 at 66 years old. And so I went back and they taught me how to wrestle. And Gordon Nelson would come work out with me. Jack and Jerry would come down and work out with me. Pat Patterson came down to help me do some stuff. And so they kind of like taught me to wrestle Florida style, like you were doing in Texas and all over, and actually have, you know, wrestling matches. And that's how I was broke in. But when I went to Japan, that's the only time I could really wrestle. Because as soon as I got a chance to go to the Fuller territory, Pecola, Mobile, Dothan, Alabama, Birmingham, as soon as I got there, they wanted me not to go down on a drop kick, big man, you know, the one arm thing, push everybody off, test the strength. They didn't want me selling. You know, they wanted me to work like Andre, kind of, because I was, you know, 300 pounds.
The biggest guy in the territory.
Yeah, thank you. So it was tough because I wanted to actually wrestle and take a backdrop for somebody or a hip toss or an arm drag, but they said, you can't do that. So even when I went to Minnesota, fast forward years later, Vern Gagne goes, we don't want you going down. Dude, that got all kind of heat from like Ken Patera and 450-pound Jerry Blackwell and all these guys that I was friends with. I said, guys, I'll have a match with you, but Vern doesn't want me going off my feet. So going to Japan and getting to wrestle was actually fun for me because in Japan, they don't talk a lot of English and they don't go over matches for hours and hours. You just go out there and you work. And so for me to go to Japan, I was in my heyday. I was having a blast there, but we did do a lot of technical wrestling in Japan, which they wouldn't let me do here.
I don't know that that would have drawn the money that you ended up drawing. And to me, when I go back and I'm watching all of these matches, one of the best things that you did, because you always think, okay, if you're going to build the perfect wrestler that's going to draw money, or let's say you got to have size, got to have some rap, ability to work, charisma. Dude, you had all that. But you're one of the biggest guys in the territory. But to me, your biggest assets, one of your hallmarks was your ability and willingness to sell. I mean, you were like Hamlet in a Shakespearean play out there. You sold your ass off. One of the biggest, other than Andre, biggest guys in the territory. Who ingrained that into you to the level that you took it to? Because there's few people that I've seen have the ability to read and understand a crowd like you could. Okay, so let's go back to it. Where did you pick up the salesmanship? Because you were basically a gigantic white meat baby face, you know, with the, you know, I'm a real American, all that stuff with WrestleMania 1 going forward. Tell me about the salesmanship, because you don't see a whole lot of big guys like you sell to the degree that you did. And I think that's why people were able to get so much heat on you. And then we'll get into the fire and the comeback in a minute.
Well, subconsciously, I really didn't know what I was watching, but I grew up watching Dusty Rhodes down here and the great Malenko and Eddie Graham, Jack and Jerry Briscoe, and all the big wrestlers that came in when the promoters were friendly in exchange in talent. Vince Sr. would send down like Ivan Putski, the Mighty Igor, superstar Billy Graham, Ivan Koloff. So I get to see everybody here. But the one thing I remember was no matter how great the matches were, as soon as Dusty Rhodes came out for the main event and somebody would chop him in the throat, he'd go right down like a tub of shit and start selling his ass off, and the place would start rumbling. So subconsciously, I was such a huge Dusty fan watching him. And then when I saw Billy Graham come in, I said, well, I want to sell like Dusty, which I didn't even know what selling was, but I want to look like him.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like had that subconsciously, and I stumbled around my first territory with the Fullers. And then I quit and went back to work on the docks loading ships because I wasn't making enough money. And then I went up and worked for Lawler and those guys. And they had it to where they didn't want me selling. They wanted me to stay strong, you know, up there. So I had a pretty good little run in Memphis. But then I quit again and went back to the docks. But when I went back up to New York in 78.
It was for the old man.
Yeah, I was just, you know, I could sell because I was working with Andre, but I was a heel. So I really didn't have it figured out completely. But then when I got fired there by Vince Sr. for doing the Rocky movie.
And why didn't he want you to do the Rocky movie?
Well, because the mindset back there wasn't like it is now. Back then.
Okay.
That we want Stone Cold to do his TV show, and we want Stone Cold to do Expendables, and we want The Rock to do this. Back then, 78, 79, if you were a wrestler, you didn't do TV. You didn't go do a movie. If you're a wrestler, you're a wrestler. And I told Vince Sr., hey, I got this call from Stallone.
And what you thought was a rib.
Yeah.
And ended up being a real deal. Yeah. And this was a launching. Dude, I remember seeing Rocky III when I saw you in that, because I've been following your career forever, because I've been watching since I was 7, and you were on top of the world. And when I saw you come out as Thunder Lips, I was like, holy shit. It was like that part was tailor-made for you. Anyway, back to your story about the salesmanship.
Yeah.
You got fired from Vince Sr.
Right. Vince Sr. fired me for doing the movie because you weren't supposed to do movies or TV shows or anything like that back then. The thinking was pretty barbaric. But then I went to Japan and I hung out there for a long time because I had a girlfriend in Japan, and I had a blast over there. Sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but it was fun. And the good thing was I sent all my pictures to Vern Gagne because I heard that Minneapolis was the territory, brother. You work 4 days a week. They fly you around on a plane. I've been driving everywhere. I don't put four Samoans in the car. I'm not used to flying on a plane, so... You know, a plane and 4 days a week and this and that and the other. And when I went into Minnesota, I sent all my promos in where I wouldn't show them my face. I said, if you want, and my arms were big back then. I was like 330 pounds and I was all yacked up and training every day. And I went in there and all my promos were with my back to the camera saying, if you want to see this face, you got to buy a ticket, you know. I was thinking that I was going to be this big heel going in there, but everybody was cheering me because they wanted me to beat Jesse's ass. And when I went up there, Vern Gagne got in my head. And Greg Gagne, I had to give him his due. They said, bro, you need to go down and stay down and start selling. So those 3 years I had in Minnesota, that's where I learned to just crawl around and beg for help and sell with my head up and don't keep my head down and show the story, you know, show them the movie with the expressions in your face and crawl and stay alive and fight back. And, you know, there's an art to the selling. Everybody has a different character, but there's a way to get that compassion and people on your side when you're down and create emotion. So 3 years in Minnesota with Vern in my ear, you know, and Greg in my ear, that's where I learned how to sell there. So when I went back to wrestle the Sheik, January 23rd, 1984, I was ready. You know, I knew what needed to be done.
You had the tools of the trade.
It took me that long to figure it out.
Okay, but then if you started in Florida, right?
Yeah.
Working for Eddie Graham.
Right.
Okay, I always heard he was a genius, and he passed before my time, and I didn't get a chance to get down there. But how much of a genius was Eddie Graham?
Well, now that I look back on it, I mean, you know, as far as finishes and stuff, you know, I mean, I have my own agenda when you're wrestling me. I've got plan A, plan B, plan C, you know, the three standard finishes, you know, and then there's sometimes D and E if we need to go there. But usually plan A, B, and C, we can draw 2-3 times with those finishes. But I watched Eddie Graham for years, even though I really didn't know what I was watching. I saw the angles. I saw all this stuff. I saw all this, these crazy finishes that Eddie Graham had, you know. Plus, he was a tough son of a bitch, you know. He was like the Stone Cold Steve Austin with platinum blonde hair. Eddie Graham was the tough guy. I don't know if you ever saw him wrestle, but that was his whole thing. And the whole time Matsuda was breaking me in, you got to realize they never smartened me up. I'm real slow about shit. You know, I love this business. And I back then, you could say whatever you want about wrestling being fake, but I thought the shit was real. And I believed it because we had Bob Roop and the big O, Randy's grandfather, you know, Bob Orton's dad. I had all these guys there, Bob Roop. I had all these guys that were just worked really, really snug. And Steve Kern was very convincing, you know, when he first started and he was having all these programs with Roop and Orton. So I watched all these guys. So when I was breaking in with Matsuda and I was getting stretched every day, and then twice a week we'd take marks down and beat them up, and I was in charge of getting them to where they were exhausted and ready to pass out. Then I'd feed them to Gordon Nelson or Matsuda, and I was in charge of putting the wood on the door so they couldn't run, you know, the sportatorium on the backside of the doors. And it was just one of those things that, you know, it was just ingrained in me from day one, you know, being around those guys. But Eddie Graham and his finishes, watching him, he was just like a genius, you know. And after I worked out in Matsuda and they stretched me and beat me up, all of a sudden I got a call one day that Eddie Graham wants to work out with you. Shoot, I started crying. I said, oh my God, I can't take anymore. I don't know what I'm in for now. I'm not going to be able to, you know. Eddie Graham was different than Matsuda. Matsuda was killing me, but Eddie Graham was like the legend. I was going to quit. I was so afraid of him. But I went down to the sportatorium. I got in the ring and he taught me how to lock up, taught me how to grab a headlock, taught me how to take a backdrop, and I started crying because I thought
it was
this was a shoot. And when they told me that this is what we do, I still didn't get it. I went and had my first match with Don Serrano, several matches with Brian Blair, and I never heard the word kayfabe. I didn't know what kayfabe meant. And I was in the ring the first match, and all the heels and all the baby faces would come out and watch my matches, and I couldn't figure out why. They were heeming and hawing and laughing because I was trying to beat Brian Blair and I was trying to beat Gordon Nelson. I couldn't beat either one of them because I didn't know how to wrestle as good as them, you know. So it took me a while to catch on. But Eddie Graham, and his finishes and stuff, he was the genius, man, from day one.
Okay, so you got some of your finish that you do, which I believe that you would kind of incorporate towards some of the classic matches that you had in the WWF days in those first WrestleMania years. I want to get to those in a minute. So all of a sudden you go to Minnesota, and it's Vern and Greg say, hey, dude, go down, stay down, sell your ass off. One time I was in I was never your size. I was about 255 when I broke into business, and I'm in Tennessee, and I'm starving. And Tojo Yamamoto, a little short Japanese guy, and, you know, Tojo was about 5'6", if that. And, you know, he's trying to tell me, because I'm this young football player, and, you know, when you come in, you think you're tough or whatever, and, hey, man, this can't hurt me because I'm bigger than you. Well, the art of the sell is to be able to, if nothing hurts you, nothing, nobody cares. So, anyway, Tojo says, here, grab my ear. And, of course, I grabbed his earlobe, and he just cringed. And I thought I heard him. I said, oh, man. He goes, that sell. And it was like a light bulb went off in my head, and I understood it. We were talking about mentors, because he put a guy with you. He was a tag guy, Tony Altimore. Just bring me up to speed on how you were hoisted away from the Ganyas. Did you want to leave? Did Junior come down there? Could you, you'd spent some time in WWF prior.
Well, I was really, God, this is a horrible thing to say, but I got to say it. I was doing really great in Minnesota. It was probably the funnest time of my life. I love the Twin Cities. It was just great being up there. I was single, and I lived in the Versailles Apartments behind the old Met Center where all the stewardesses used to stay. And I was there, so I had the time of my life. And, you know, I actually slid in to Minnesota when I left Japan. I said, Vern, all my pictures. But when I slid in there, as we were talking before, I thought I was going to be a heel, but the Crusher had just left. He was like the Dusty Rhodes, or, you know, or John Cena or Stone Cold. No, he wasn't a heel half the time, but the Crusher was always a babyface. And I didn't realize it, but I stumbled into his spot. So I was there 3 years, doing great, making all kind of money. And I remember we were in the Rosemont Horizon, and it was Hulk Hogan and Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel in a six-man tag. Of course, the place was sold out. I had to say that. Against, come on, brother, I got to say it, it was true.
Yeah, and what a great villain.
Yeah, against Sheik Adnan El Casey, Sheik Ken Patera, and Sheik Jerry Blackwell, right? They were all under the garb. And all of a sudden, when I got ready to go to the ring, Steve Taylor, I don't know if you know Steve, he used to be the in-house photographer. Yep. He goes, hey, Terry, how you doing? I said, Steve, what are you doing here? Because I was good friends with Steve. You know, it was me, him, and Vince in the very beginning, even before Patterson showed up. It was me, Steve Taylor, and Vince in that office every day. And so all of a sudden, he goes, take this card. And it says, call Vince. I said, I'm not calling Vince. He told me I'd never work there again. Well, let me take a picture. And he took a picture with the little white headband I had on. And it was like this picture with the white headband. It was the first cover of the WWF magazine they came out with. And I said, I'm not. And I took the picture. I said, Steve, I'm not calling Vince. He goes, no, Vince Jr. wants you to call him. So I said, okay. So one thing led to another. I got home. I called Vince Jr. And he said, I'm getting ready to take over from my dad, and I want you to fly into New York here. I want to talk to you about, you know, building my whole promotion and stuff around you and your character. And I said, nah, I'm not flying to New York. I go, you know, if you want to talk to me, fly to Minnesota. So I was with my ex-wife, Linda, at the time, which we were engaged. I didn't want to be seen at the airport with him, you know.
Dude, kayfabe. I mean, because, you know, if Vern hears about this, he's going to go through the roof.
Yeah, so anyway, Linda goes to the airport, and she goes, how am I going to recognize him? He's going to be some guy coming out. He's going to have a suit on with these big puffed-up shoulder pads. It'll probably be a pink or a checkered suit or something, but the suit's going to be off the wall. And sure enough, she grabbed him off the plane. We went to my house. We had a few drinks, you know what I'm saying? And about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, we shook hands and for me to come back. And what he said he wanted to do was go into all these territories that the boundary lines had never been crossed and pipe our signal in there and then go in and try to draw some money and just kind of like slowly take over the whole United States and then internationally. So I said, you're going to sit up in the Eiffel Tower, and I'm going to go into Harley Race's backyard, and I'm going to go into Bill Watts's backyard. I said, sure, let's do it. You know, the kid, they can, they're not going to kill me, you know. So, and I knew, you know, what I was kind of in for. So when Vince said that, you know, I was all up for it, and I just bought a house from Kathy Gagne. in Minnesota. And the backstory on that, Larry Zbyszko ended up marrying her, but I was supposed to be the first victim, and I dodged that bullet. Vern was pushing that thing real hard. She was a gorgeous-looking girl, beautiful body on her, but she looked just like Greg in the face. I couldn't deal with it. And she's a sweetheart. She's a good girl. I'm going to get heat for that. But anyway, I went ahead, and before Vince came in to Minnesota, I had just sat around the pool with Vern and Nick Bockwinkel, and they had booked me in all the cage matches with Nick Bockwinkel all the way around the territory for the next couple months in all the main events. And I went home and then, you know, wrestled Chicago, got the thing from Steve Taylor, called Vince. And so when Vince came in, we made the deal. Next thing I know, we're packing up shop from this brand new house I bought. And I, of course, had to say, Dr. D's got to come with me. David's got to come with me. So me and David and his wife and Linda all moved up to New Haven and rented a house. And that was a circus in itself. But I went to Madison Square Garden, and I was supposed to win the belt that night. But before that happened, I made some TVs. And I went out there with Backlund, and we had a tag match against the Wild Samoans. And then after that, Backlund went to Vince Sr. He goes, I don't want to team up with Hulk anymore. And he drew a line in the sand. He didn't want to be my partner. He didn't want to be around me. And it was, you know, Vince Jr. goes, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You know, Bob's just in shock because he doesn't have the belt. He thinks it's a shoot, you know. And so the night of Madison Square Garden, you know, I'm in the garden, standing in the hallway, and Vince has those kind of glasses down on his nose, and he's clicking the quarters together looking at me. Vince is here. Vince Sr.'s here, I'm here, and Bob Backlund's standing here, and he's covered with hives. He's covered in head to toe with hives because he thought he was going to win the belt back from the Sheik, but plans had changed after I made the deal with Vince. So all of a sudden, we're talking, and Vince Sr. is looking at me, and, you know, Bob Backlund speaks up, and he says, I don't think anybody should win the title that's not a real athlete. I looked at Backlund. I've been training with him in Japan, on tours with him. I'm the only one that'll run the steps with him. I'm the only one that'll do that crazy workout he was doing. And he shot that angle on the spot that he didn't think I should win the belt because I'm not a real athlete, you know. And Vince goes, well, you know, Terry, you know, we should think this thing through. And I think maybe about 6 months from now, you know, it might be a good time to put the belt on. I said, Vince Sr., in all due respect, that's not the deal I made with your son. But I just burnt down a huge bridge in Minnesota. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to put the Sheik over tonight. But then I'm going right back and rebuild that bridge that I just burnt down. And I'm out of here. And Vince Jr. goes, oh, let's talk. So Vince took me in the back room. He goes, I'll be back in a few minutes. So I guess he went to his dad and he fixed it. So the finish was on where I was still going to go over. But there was a moment there, you know, in the garden. And I was cool. I was going to do the job, but I was gone. And Junior came back and said, hey, things are on the plan and this and that and the other. And I went out and did the Iron Sheik did the job for me. Little did I know, Vern had contacted the Sheik and said, I'll give you $100,000 if you break Hogan's leg. You know?
Shoot.
Yeah. And so after that, Kaz goes, I can't believe it, but I did the best thing. You know, I did the businessman. You know, Vern wanted me to break your leg because Kaz broke in with Vern. Right. You know, and he broke in with Vern. So they were tight. So I got through it all on a whim and a wish, you know.
Go back a little bit and talk about your relationship with Dr. D. David Schultz.
Yeah. But
because, man, all of a sudden you guys are gangbusters. And then conflicting stories at the end and over several years of what happened here, there, whatever. But, you know, when I watched, and I didn't get a chance to see a whole lot of Dr. D because when the Stossel stuff went down in the garden and he was gone, you know, all these years later, after or maybe in the latter part of my years of Stone Cold, I saw a lot of his promos.
Yeah.
And our characters were very similar, but I can't say that he was an influence because I didn't see him do that stuff.
You and him were so close, you have no idea.
I know, and I think, you know, he was 20 years too soon. Had he come, he would have been, you know, he really was the first Stone Cold. I think actually Superstar Billy Graham could have been the first Stone Cold, but when Vince Sr. was booking him because he was hot as a heel, then people started liking him, and then Backlund beat him, and then he left because it screwed his head up so much. But he was that guy that really, as a heel, started entertaining people so much. I don't think the senior saw the foresight or the vision to do what Junior did with me back then. But anyway, so the friendship with you and Dr. D developed just because you're what, like-minded people, like to run around and have fun or what?
It was a situation is when I quit. I broke in, lasted a few months in Florida, didn't get booked and quit. Went over to Cocoa Beach and I opened a gym. Because when I played music, there was this 40-year-old guy with blonde hair that worked out on the top of the club, and he was single and had all these girls. So I called him and I said, "Hey, Whitey, I just quit wrestling. I have a job." He goes, "Oh, come on over and help me run the bar." So I went over to help him run the Anchor Club. Plus, we opened a gym over there. And then after a year, first off, I was an idiot. I wouldn't allow any girls in the gym. Old school bodybuilding.
Wow.
No girls allowed.
Dude, bad move.
I know.
But I understand. Old school.
No girls allowed. But we were making so much money with the Rock and Roll Club, we didn't give a crap. We had a blast. Then President Carter shut the space shuttle down, and overnight it turned to a ghost town. Nobody, everybody left, you know, all the families left. And so I got on the phone, and I called superstar Billy Graham up, and I said, "I've been training for a year, twice a day. I drink 2 gallons of milk a day. I eat 30 old school Danny yogurts a day." I said, "I just tape my arms, Billy. My arms are 24 inches and I'm bigger than you are." He goes, "Oh, bullshit." I said, "I am." So I sent him a picture. He couldn't believe it. And I was huge back then because all I did was eat and take the gimmick and, you know, all the other stuff to get big. And so he booked me. He said, "Well, I got a guy named Louis Tillett I'm friends with. Drive to Pensacola and meet Louis." And they were in Panama City that night at a building next to a bowling alley. And I drove up. I walked in the back door. And when I walked in the back door, I stepped in the heel dressing room. And there was Dr. David Schultz, Wayne Ferris, the Honky Tonk Man, Terry Latham, Ricky Fields. I don't know if you know any of these old guys back in the day from the Fuller territory. Ron and Robert Fuller. And they said, "Hey, kid, you're in the wrong dressing room." So I had to walk around the building and go in the babyface dressing room, which I had no idea, you know, what I was supposed to be. So I went out and I had a match. I hadn't had a match in about a year. And then I started working every night, and I got over instantly because of the way I looked. I was so tan. I had a full head of hair. I was couldn't do anything except do the Austin Idol strongman stuff. But what happened was I found out that all the wrestlers lived in Pensacola. And they lived in a hotel that was right next to Machine Gun Kelly's, a bar. So I started parking my van in the parking lot at where the boys stayed at their apartments. And I slept in my van for about 3 months out in the parking lot.
Shoot.
Yeah. Slept in my van. And then I'd run down to the beach, and me and Alpha and Sika, we'd get showers in the public restroom there and hang out and raise hell all day and smoke weed and drink beer. And then we'd go to the towns later that night. But, David Schultz found out I was sleeping in my car. So he came up banging. "Hey, what's in there, boy? What are you, gay in there? What are you doing?" David's banging on my truck. And he goes, "What are you doing out here?" I said, "I'm just trying to sleep, man." He goes, "Well, come on in." And so him and the Honky Tonk Man were roommates, and they let me sleep on the floor in the living room. So that's where we became friends.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's a real interesting guy.
Yeah.
What was the business pitch from Junior, just as far as, and we'll never talk numbers, but just how did he convince you to leave Vern and say, "Hey, man, this is the promised land"? Or was it the fact that, "Hey, man, based on your character and you being the centerpiece of our promotion and we're going to take over the United States together," was that enough?
Well, you got to realize, even though I was in the wrestling business, I'm still a big mark. Still am to this day. And not to rain on anybody's parade, but I've heard a lot of guys bragging about, if it wasn't for us, there'd be no guaranteed contracts and all that stuff. Well, in 1983, I had a guaranteed contract. When I decided to leave Vern to go to Vince, I had a 10-year deal with a minimum guarantee. So I had the first guaranteed contract. You know, not to rain on anybody's parade, but what lured me back was the fact that I was a mark. And I love Madison Square Garden. All of a sudden, Vince said he's going to put the WWF or the WWE World title, whatever you call it, on me, you know, and going to give me a chance. And now I'd figured out this babyface thing in Minnesota for 3 years. I knew what it was like just to look at the crowd and have them stand up and go crazy. I knew what it was like to slam somebody and look at the crowd and get 10 times the reaction from the look than the move. And I was ready, you know. And so I kind of like knew that if I didn't trip falling through the ropes or I didn't shit the bed during the match and, you know, things went well, that with the right ambiance and the right momentum that I could get over with this thing. So what brought me back there was the opportunity to be the champion and have that one run through New York. And I told my girl I was engaged to, Linda, at the time, I said, look, I just want to go back to New York for 1 year. 1 year, and then we're done. We'll be fine.
Easier said than done.
Yeah, and I was looking for 1 year, and the thing just took off. It just took off like crazy. And when I went back, nobody played music in WWE.
Correct.
And I came back and played Eye of the Tiger the first night, which got some people upset when I was told I couldn't do it, and I did it anyway.
Yeah, but when you're in the arena and all of a sudden that's blasting over the speakers and here comes you walking out, it was like the Von Erichs when they came out with Stranglehold or whatever modern-day warrior carries music. I mean, and I think Michael PSAs might take credit for playing being one of the first people down in the South to come out to music.
Yeah.
But it wasn't being done back then, so continue.
Yeah, and also I had just had a huge blowout with Vern over merchandise because I was making these shirts at the Yorktown Mall there on France Avenue in Minnesota and selling more shirts and making a lot of money selling t-shirts, which nobody else did. And so when I went to Japan and I came back, I came to TV one day and Vern's sitting there, there's a stack of my shirts there. And you know, I said, Vern, what's going on here? He goes, oh, we've been selling your shirts since you've been gone. And I said, well, how many did you sell? And we haven't made a deal. What's my deal? He goes, oh, you're not getting anything for this. So we had a little physical encounter there, which thank God I came up on top during that thing with David Schultz egging it on. When I went to work for Vince, nobody played music and nobody sold t-shirts. So first thing I did was run to Vince, go, man, we need to start making Hulkamania shirts and doing this and that and the other, all this merchandise. And they hadn't even gone in that direction yet. So no merchandise, bro. They weren't doing any of that. No music, no merchandise.
Okay, let me cut in here, man, because one of the things I've always respected about you or heard about, and because you were the guy, you were always, I'm looking down, you were a business major in college, and you dropped out your music minor, you were going to be an accountant, but you had a business brain, but you get in the business, you start learning, you know, hey, man, you know, here's what I need to be getting paid. But your business acumen, it seems to me like you've been a tremendous businessman. And you're one of the first guys that ever used lawyers in this business. Am I right on that?
Yeah, no, it's true.
But I mean, so I just think it's keen because I always talk to today's generation and say, hey man, you need to learn the business aspects to learn what you got coming to you. You were always ahead of that curve. Would you disagree with that?
I kind of was.
You push the envelope, dude.
Yeah, I kind of was because there was so much stuff that came my way that all of a sudden it was out of the box of just wrestling, getting a payday and a six pack of beer and going down to the next town. Things were coming at me so fast. All of a sudden the movie stuff started coming and just a ton of these low budget little kids movies I did. I don't know, 14 or 15, I don't know how many there were, but stuff was coming at so fast. I needed legal stuff and legal help. And then, you know, the contracts and the merchandising and stuff, I couldn't do it on my own. You know, so I needed some type of, you know, security to make sure that everything, you know, ran as it should. And I had to bring the lawyers in. But I think I was probably the first one to bring a lawyer in to negotiate stuff.
No, but that's an interesting point because, you know, back in the day, you know, even when I negotiated a couple of contracts and I was in a small dressing room, man, a little bitty room with Vince, Jim Ross, and Bruce Pritchard. And we're in there right before show's fixing to start, and they're pitching a deal to me.
Yeah.
And, that's how it was. But I guess, would you say then, due to all the, you know, the fact that you were Thunder Lips in Rocky III, and all of a sudden, you know, you can come from a wrestling background, and all of a sudden, when you step into that world, you are introduced to the lawyers because of all the way the royalties are in the pay and everything like that. So all of a sudden, you get a Hello McFly knock on the head. It's like, yes, WWE's got dozens and dozens, or every wrestling company has lawyers. And so the fact that, you know, most of the boys would negotiate contracts without any help of a lawyer, hey, it's great to ride down the road and get a paycheck and have fun, like you said, and go get a six-pack of beer. But at the end of the day, man, we'd all say, hey, man, God dang, I'm having so much fun. I do this for free. But that ain't the point. The point is to get paid.
Right, right. And, you know, I knew when I hit that ring in January of 84 against the Iron Sheik, it was kind of like the perfect storm for me. And I knew, you know, after doing so well in Minnesota with the t-shirts and stuff, that if I got over back in New York, things are really going to blow. And it was like the perfect storm because they were holding like 444 hostages in Iran at the time.
Right.
And America was at turmoil with Iran, and Kaz, the Iron Sheik, was actually the real bodyguard of the Shah back in the day. So I said, if we can hit a home run on this thing, we need shirts made, man. We need headbands and shirts made. That's what I was thinking about. I wasn't thinking about pinball machines and video games or any of that kind of crap. I was thinking, man, how many shirts we could sell, you know? So it kind of like got Vince, you know, lit up pretty quick with a merchandising idea.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
When your favorite show ends, Rob's sister Nino is just getting started with post-show recaps on Podcast One.
Sign me up.
Join him for live interactive podcasts right after episodes of your favorite shows like Big Little Lies and Star Trek Discovery, plus Netflix original shows like Stranger Things and so much more.
I want to see Stranger Things in the big city. I want some Chicago redemption.
Okay, it's another Dick Wolf production, Chicago Stranger Things.
Yes.
Download new episodes of post-show recaps every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Going up there to New York for the second time, and all of a sudden, Vince comes up with this idea for WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And so what were your thoughts on that? No one ever done it before.
Well, you know, at the time, it was, you got to realize it wasn't this big corporate thing. It was it was almost like a real personal thing. Like if you and I and one of your friends were to talk about strategy and how we're going to start our new company or our roofing company or our car dealership. When I first went up there, I was in that office every day with just me and Vince and maybe one other guy. Patterson came in about a year and a half later. But when he started talking about the WrestleMania thing, I'd only been up there about a year, and he was talking about leveraging stuff and selling the farm and putting his house up. I mean, he pretty much rolled the dice on this WrestleMania thing. Everything that he owned and he had, he put the money on the line for that. In the match, which was really crazy with me and Mr. T against Piper and Orndorff, that was Dr. D's idea. It was going to be Hulk Hogan against Mr. T, against Roddy Piper and Dr. D. That it was David's idea. And so all of a sudden, we hadn't started promoting it, and Vince was thinking it through, and David decided to shoot an angle, his own angle, at the LA Forum, where out of nowhere, I had T sitting in ringside because he's a friend of mine, and I didn't know what was going on. David rolled out of the ring and bitch slapped the hell out of him, just out of nowhere, a shoot slap. So when T came over the rail, we had to separate him, but Chief Strongbow sent the cops down, and they shackled David behind his back and carried him out, you know. And after that, he was pretty much done. Vince was so pissed at him, that pretty much was the bullet that did him in. But the original idea for WrestleMania was supposed to be Piper and Dr. D, because David came up with the damn idea for the match. And it turned out to be what it was, but Vince leveraged everything he had, and if we would have, you know, shit the bed that night, the party would have been over.
Well, if you're hanging out with Vince that much, almost from the get-go, and you're going to be his number one guy, man, how did you guys, you know, just develop your relationship? Because I always tell everybody, hey, man, you got to have a relationship with Vince because he's the boss. But the more you're with him, at the higher level you're working with him, man, the closer you become because the stakes are so much greater. So you're in there hanging out with a guy all the time. How long did it take for you guys to become close, or were you close, or what was the relationship or the dynamic of the relationship? Because, you know, I've seen highs and lows between you two.
Yeah, it's always been weird. It's always been like a love-hate relationship. That really didn't start until, you know, I got too full of myself or he got too full of himself, one or the other.
But that would have been like after like a WrestleMania 8, because you were headlining seven of the eight first WrestleManias.
Right. And for me, I had known Vince, whatever it was, 78 or 77, 78, 79 when I first went up there, and he was the commentator. He would come in once every 3 weeks to Allentown in Reading just to do the commentating. So I kind of knew him then, and he partied a lot with Morocco and the Grand Wizard and all these guys every once in a while. So he was kind of like around the boys a little bit, but he was mostly with his dad, you know. And I kind of knew him then. But then when I moved up there the end of 83, 84, you know, it was business that we needed to be together. And when we were bonding business, we became close friends. You know, we were riding Harleys around all the time and working out all the time. And, you know, it was basically Vince and I in the office going over all the events, all the finishes, talking things through, I became real close with him in a short amount of time. But what I realized was he loves this business more than anybody. I mean, I thought I love this business. He loves this business more than anybody. He lives it 24/7. And out of that, I just a huge respect grew because I'd never been around anybody that loved wrestling more than I did. So it was really cool to be around him all the time. I'd leave my wife at home. She was down the road. Linda was down the road at some big house I'd bought 12 hours a day. I wouldn't even go home. I'd wake up at 9 o'clock. I'm going to go work out with Vince. I'll be home in a little while. I'd get in the office. I wouldn't even come home. I just love being around all this stuff.
And me too. And obviously you're right there with him. But when did it really start to turn the promotion on fire or the territory on fire as y'all began this global expansion and you started with WrestleMania 1? When you signed on from AWA, how long did it take for the place to catch fire? Because when I watch back on those old videotapes or on the WWE Network, I mean, you guys were playing big arena stadiums way back in the day. And, of course, go to the Silverdome at WrestleMania 3, 93,000. How long was it before it just turned into utter chaos? Because when you go back and you do the years, to draw those kind of houses back in that day, they're just now doing it now. I mean, I played Astrodome. We drew 67,000. We were Ford Field. We had 90,000. Y'all were doing this stuff way back in the day. So how was that for you to go from humble beginnings, good money with Vern, but now all of a sudden you're the man and things start taking off? How long did it take to get there? Sorry for the long-winded question. I'm a shits at this.
No, it was instantly.
Okay.
I mean, it was not, it's almost like everything had built up, you know, almost like something exploding, like a volcano or something. But for whatever reason, the backstory with the Rocky, and I'd been there before, we'd sold out Shea Stadium with me and Andre and Zabisco and Bruno. And, you know, we'd had some, whenever I wrestled Andre, you know, we had huge crowds because Andre was over like crazy. And all of a sudden, it's kind of like when I came back, it was almost like they were ready for something new. They'd had about 5 years of Backlund, you know, doing his thing. And I think they were ready for a character. So as soon as we hit Madison Square Garden, my memory's not that great. But what I remember is that was a rocket ship ride from that day forward. And I hate to sound like this, but it was sold out everywhere we went and everything we did. Strombo used to put his hands behind his back and call me the Golden Goose and just teasing me, you know. And I was really, you know, I wasn't trying to take advantage of the situation, but I wasn't real great at being on time because I used to like to work out and I used to like to party a little bit during the day, you know. And so I would kind of like show up at the buildings instead of like at 6 o'clock or 6:30 when I should be there. I'd sometimes show up at 7 or I'd show up during intermission. And I would tell everybody, if you don't hear from me, if I do not call you, everything's fine. I'll be here. If you get a phone call from me, then we got a problem. And I only missed one show the whole time I was there all those years, and that's when I got fogged in and I couldn't land in St. Louis. But I always made the towns. But it was a rocket ship from the moment the Iron Sheik thing went down. It just took off.
What was the difference when you go back to thinking about some of your matches with Andre the Giant, the match in Shea Stadium when he would have been a little bit more in his prime versus 3 when he wasn't feeling real good and you slammed him? What was the difference between working Andre kind of, you know, prime and then kind of post-prime and just the magic or the mystique of working with Andre and the reality of it?
There were two things that were different between Shea Stadium and then later on when Andre, like WrestleMania 3, when Andre had some health problems. The main difference was we were friends at WrestleMania 3. Shea Stadium, he didn't like me. And I was like, you know, I had a hard time with it because I was booked with him everywhere. And I was just this, I don't know what it was, I was such a fan and such a mark. In my mind, when I looked at Andre, I thought that I could be as big as him or I could be the Giant. I know I couldn't be, but in my mind, I was just an idiot.
And that's the competitive side of all of us.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought I could go after this guy. I would fight him tooth and nail. And he'd go, calm down. You know, he would yell at me in the ring because first off, I was green. You know, I was probably dangerous. But with him, I was just trying to show that I was a worthy opponent. And he just beat on me like a dog for about 7 or 8 years. And I just remember driving up to Philadelphia Spectrum or the Capitol Center because we drove everywhere. When I'd see the building, I'd realize Andre was in there, and I'd pull up my car and I'd puke. That's how scared of him I was and nervous. And then once I got in there, and we made contact, I was okay. But by WrestleMania 3, we'd spent so much time in Japan together, and he saw me fight for my life over there, because Japan back in the 70s was a lot different than it is nowadays. And he saw me fighting for my life over there when Inoki would call me up going, oh, we're shooting tomorrow, and all this Gotch's boy Fujinami said, oh, we're going to have to shoot, and all this stupid crap they were doing, you know, that Andre kind of like watched me. He goes, okay, this guy's okay. You know, he's cool. He loves the business. Then we became really good friends. We were inseparable. So by the time we got to WrestleMania 3, we sat in the locker room all day. He drank a couple bottles of Crown Royal. I was sitting there, and I kept dumping mine because I couldn't keep up with him, you know, when he wasn't looking. And thank God he didn't catch me, or I'd have been dead. But we were good friends, you know. And so when we went out to WrestleMania 3, you know, I was really upset and worried about what we were doing in the finish, and Andre just kept telling me, don't worry. You know, I asked him about the slam, don't worry. Am I going over? Are you going over? Don't worry. So I actually went out there not knowing what we were doing or what the finish was. Nothing.
I've heard you say this 100 times.
Yeah.
Shoot.
Shoot. Shoot. But what the weird thing was is Vince put me in a really bad spot, because the night before the match, he came to my room and he said, Andre is in a really bad spot with his back and stuff. What would you do, you know, to get through the match with Andre? So I took a yellow legal pad out and I started writing the match down. You know, and I've never done the Diamond Dallas Page thing before, but I started writing the match down. I said, walk to the center of the ring, start jibber-jabbing at each other, have Andre throw the punch, block it, 1, 2, 3, go for the slam, fall backwards. I wrote it all down. Step on me once, step on me twice, slam me once, slam me the second time, headbutt off his thigh. I wrote all the stuff down the whole time, keeping Andre next to the ropes, even when I fell backwards with a slam on him close enough to the ropes where he could pull himself up. Everything I wrote down, the match from A to Z with a question mark on the finish, and I had a slam in the match with a question mark, the whole legal pad, I wrote everything down. I gave it to Vince. And I said, if you let Andre know I did this, if you tell him I wrote this down, I don't know how you're going to present him this, but I will be a fucking dead man. And I'm serious, because he does not like anything like this. He likes to call it in the ring. He doesn't want to talk. And if you show him I did this, I'm dead. Vince must have went and talked to him, because everything I wrote down was exactly the way the match went. It's exactly what I wrote down is what we did. And the question mark for the slam, Andre yelled in the middle of the ring, slam, you know, about towards the end. And then he said, drop the leg. I dropped the leg. I didn't know if he was going to kick out or not. And he didn't kick out.
Man, to me, I rewatched that match last night, and of course I've seen it a million times, and I saw it when it went down. But that was a genius match, because for you to fire up after blocking his shot, a couple of punches, go for the slam, and of course when the way you fall down and you have to twist your leg out from under you from getting it crushed, and then to start selling that back, you're immediately, you know, you don't need to be shined up.
Right.
I mean, in theory, you're the babyface. But you don't need to be shined up. You're fighting from underneath the entire match.
It was, brother.
It made so much sense.
It was there from the moment we walked in the ring, such as it would have been there if you would have ever wrestled me. That's what would have happened. It would have been, we could have looked at each other and the roof would have blown off the place. You were so over at the time. And they hated me so much from trying to put WWE out of business for 10 years. They would have been great. But anyway, I'll get off that.
No, we'll get
that's
get
in my crawl, brother, that I never got to work with you.
Dude, I was in such a different headspace back when that window of opportunity presented itself. And sometimes I kick myself in the ass over it. And I think, man, I don't know. I was so frazzled towards the end. I was just in a bad space. And I don't know. It never happened. And it should have happened. But you know what I think... If we could have just gotten a room, you and I, and just talked, because you know what, and you probably never told, you probably never knew this, but I was down, and we're gonna jump back to a little bit of you know, stuff back in the early days of WWF, but you remember when you had, you know, those headline those seven out of eight WrestleManias down there in WWF, you left, man, what, 93, 92, but you ended up in WCW in 94?
Yeah, 94.
Okay, I remember all of a sudden the word on the street, I'm Stunning Steve, man, I'm upcoming, I'm going to be the next Ric Flair. Well, we always know that there's never going to be another Ric Flair, there's never going to be another Hulk Hogan, there's only going to be the next whoever you are. But all of a sudden, here comes the biggest attraction in the history of the business to WCW. And I'm thinking, great. And I'm sitting there right across from you wearing your house. And I say this with respect because I've respected your career. But I'm thinking, okay, here comes the top attraction in the world. He's coming to WCW. I was fine when you were in WWF, and all of a sudden you come down there, and now I'm another notch further down the ladder. And I always had this grudge against you because now, you know, you were the guy.
Yeah.
Now how am I going to overtake this when I can't even get past, you know, three-quarter mid-card status? So there was always that grudge, and it was competitive. I was like, man, why is this guy here now? Well, I know why you're here now, you know, in retrospect, when I look back. But when you're in the trenches and you're in the ring every night, there's that competitive part. You watch NBA players or Major League Baseball players, NFL players talk about another player. They'll put them over to a degree, but it's never very much because it's so competitive. The same with our business.
Yeah.
Just back when I would say, talk about Shawn Michaels. These days, I call him the greatest in-ring performer of all time as far as execution and being able to do everything. Back in the day, I was a high spot artist. You know, that was my perception back in because I couldn't put him over then.
Yeah.
And so anyway, it was always this thing, and then all of a sudden I turn into Stone Cold, and then you come back from WCW, where I got squashed down another notch. But I think if we'd ever gotten to a room and had a chill conversation, we probably could have done business together. And that'd probably be one of the biggest regrets of my career, other than not, jobbing for Brock. I never would have done a job, but I wish I would have showed up. But I would have loved to have worked a program with you. Especially now in my post prime, looking back at all the stuff that you did, and I was a fan from day one anyway. But you know what I mean? When you get caught up in inner workings, I guess I was in my head, and I guess I worked myself into a shoot, and it was just a dumb thing for me to do.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that certain you got to treat people on a case by case basis, and certain people have a grudge or a hard on, or they don't misunderstand, or they're out of their mind, or they're consumed with something because it could be business or personal, or your lady could drive you crazy, or you just don't know what's going on. And when I went down to WCW, I had some personal stuff at home that I would walk down the hallway and there would be 20 people in the hallway and I didn't see anybody. I was out of my mind. I was so worried about my home life and the problems I were having at home that, you know, stuff happened, and I don't mean to call anybody out, but stuff happened, for instance, where and maybe this was in the WWF or whatever it was when I went back for the Raw's 15th anniversary, but I walked in the dressing room there, and there was a guy there named CM Punk. I didn't know who he was, and I heard I had heat because when I came back, I didn't say hello to him when I walked through the hall. But I remember that night flying in with RVD from California, and I was going through so much crap on the phone when I landed, and my whole life was falling apart at home, that when I walked through that dressing room, brother, all I could think about was, I just need to get home and fix my life falling apart. And I don't remember seeing, meeting, talking, or disrespecting anybody that day, but I had to live with that because I was in that space at the time, you know? So when I went to the WWE, and I knew I was working with The Rock, I'm all about making the money, brother. And as a heel, I could put anybody over and go back the next week and say, Stone Cold never beat me. I mean, I could lie my ass off. So when I got the reaction I had with The Rock, my sights were set on you because I thought it was going to be you first. But Vince asked me to work with The Rock, and I said, sure, but I was trying to get to you. And I understand you had a bunch of physical stuff and maybe mentally. So I get it, bro. I totally get it. And we'd all like to wind the clock back, but I've been there, and I've done stuff not knowing I did it that got heat on me. I've made decisions because of I was screwed up in the head personally or because of some business crap if I was arguing with Vince, and I made decisions which I wish I could have changed them. People don't understand what's really going on all the time, but I get that, brother. But the one thing I wanted to tell you, if I could have ever got to you, was I'm like this in the ring, bro. I mean, I'm like, I got the Ray Stevens thing going on, you know what I'm saying? And so if your legs were hurt or something, I'd have never touched you. That's what I wanted to tell you, that we can do this.
Yeah, and it wasn't the physicality thing because I could have still gone. It was just, if we could have just gotten her, it wasn't about the physicality. It was just because I was so on a different page And I guess I was pissed off.
You've been run to death too.
I was you know, getting fizzled out, and I was running hard. I want to fast forward a little bit, and we can't cover your whole career, and nor was I trying to. But when Ultimate Warrior came in, all of a sudden he starts coming in and getting hot. I used to go down to the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas. I was playing football at North Texas State University. He was coming in, Dingo Warrior. And he'd already been to Blade Run with Sting down in Tennessee. I said, hey, man, this guy's probably going somewhere, you know, mechanically in the ring, you know, and Zach Wilde from Black Label Society, that's his favorite wrestler.
Yeah.
And, you know, against guys, you know, as far as reading crowds or workers, I think probably you would agree with me on this, or I've heard you say it, you can disagree. To me, the greatest professional wrestler that ever lived was Nature Boy Ric Flair.
For me?
Yeah.
I call him my champion. And when I talk to him on the phone a couple times a week, I said, how's the greatest wrestler that ever lived doing today? That's
okay,
how
so
I feel about him.
You're on the same
him.
Page, right?
Yes, sir, brother.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So, and you're probably the biggest draw of all
time. He had the gimmick, and he worked the Stone Cold, the Hulk Hogan gimmick. He had the Ric Flair gimmick. But he fucking wrestled like Jack Briscoe and Harley Race, and he was believable. And he could put everybody over, and he didn't need to win because he would roll out of the ring bleeding with a belt, you know, and he'd just stumble off into oblivion. He knew how to do it all. He could do it all.
Absolutely. But back to the Warrior. So, yeah. You know, I knew he was going to be a star.
Yeah.
He comes into WWF, of course, Vince's body guy. And, you know, for obvious reasons. And Warrior looked great on TV, very charismatic. And, you know, he had his thing, and it caught on. So you guys go to work. Is WrestleMania six? Okay. Y'all put that match comes together. A couple times he gets a little lost during the match. And, man, I'm watching you, man, and you are just such a ring general in that match. You're grabbing him up. He kicks out. You're on him like glue.
He wanted to go home then.
Yes.
I put that rear chin knock on.
Yep. And you were going to put the time in.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm watching all your matches from those first seven. And to the rest of your career, you always put the time in. To build and tell a story, the one with you and Mach from the Mega Powers, you know, put the time in. There's Elizabeth, neutral corner. All of a sudden, she gets taken to the back, you know, from helping him, helping you. But you always incorporate all these different things. Here's Warrior. You're talking him through this match. How was that? I mean, because you kept him, and he's no longer with us. And I call Jim on a personal basis every now and then, and I'd call him Warrior because that's what his name was. So I'm not going to speak out of turn of him because I was a big fan. And I remember one time at my first WrestleMania there, at WrestleMania 12, I was wrestling Savio Vega. But Warrior was always cool to me and treated me with respect when I was just a nobody. So, and I've always been a fan of his. So you're working with the man. How was it, or how chaotic or frenetic was it? Because he was all about the hype and, you know, the high energy stuff. You're a thinking guy, and you know the adrenaline, and you're working the crowd better than anybody in the history of the business. How was it being in there with the man and keeping him on an even keel to get through that match? And then I want to talk about the finish, because a real genius kick out at 3 1/4. Talk about the man first.
Well, first off, you know, I got to back up just a little bit. You know, I had the red and yellow. I had the big tan. You know, I had the whatever, the Hollywood, not Hollywood, the California, whatever it was. Whatever the Venice Beach thing was. I'm not from Venice Beach. I'm from Clearwater. But anyway, the California, land of opportunity, the tan, the blonde hair, or whatever I had left of it. And I had my gimmick going. So visually, I had a little bit different gimmick than anybody else, because I was always tan and stuff, because I'm dark anyway without being in the sun. But all of a sudden, the Ultimate Warrior shows up. He's got the red and yellow and the blue and the purple on, but he's got neon colors on. And I've got a big set of arms, and I got one big ab, and he's got a 12-pack. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting in the room, and I'm watching Vince look at him and look at me. Well, actually, really not look at me anymore, but looking at him. And Vince is calculating the dollar signs. So to go back there, I could see visually he was, to Vince, looks like a better package to draw money than me, because I'd been around for a while.
But also maybe a fresh horse.
Yes.
Because you had been around.
Yes, a fresh horse. But when we were going to do the WrestleMania thing, we did the build up pretty darn good. And then Vince told me the finish. And my question is always, whether I'm going over or not, why are we doing this? And what's next? And so when Vince told me he wanted me to put the Warrior over, I said, okay, well, why are we doing this? And then where we go from here? He goes, well, you know, I kind of think that the red and yellow run is pretty much over, you know, and I think, you know, we've kind of got everything we can out of the red and yellow thing. And, you know, let's just kind of take a little break from this, but I want you to put Jim over. And I went, damn, Vince, what about after the finish? And I point to God and I give him the belts and everything. I go halfway down that aisle and I do that stop and I do that slow Three Stooges turn. Slowly I turn and I go back, and when he's up there celebrating, I gaff his ass and I crucify him and I call myself Triple H, Hollywood Hulk Hogan. Oh, that'll never work. You can't be a heel. You've been a babyface too. I said, Vince, I was a heel when I first came in here. I can be a heel, but now I know more. I can be a great heel. Vince says, no, you can't be a heel. So Vince kind of squashed the Hollywood Hulk Hogan deal. And we had a couple years there that were kind of turbulent, where they put the belt on the Warrior and they had to take the belt right off him because he wasn't drawn, you know. But when I was in the ring with him, I told him in the back room, which I never did, I kind of like laid the match out for him. Not everything, but I laid out this, and I probably had A, B, C, D, E. And what we did in the middle wouldn't matter, but we're going to hit these A, B, C, D, E spots. And so we got going in the match, and I could tell right away, we did the push-off stuff and the strongman stuff and all that stuff. And I started chopping meat a little bit on him, and I could tell he was blown sky high. So I put a rear chin lock on him as I held him down. I said, brother, just breathe and calm down. And he's going, no, man, let's go home now. Let's go home. I'm going, brother, we've only got about 5 or 6 minutes, and we're not going home. And I told him, he goes, no, let's go home now. Because the crowd was rumbling. He goes, let's go home. I said, no, brother. You're going to have to press me over your head in the gorilla press, and I'm going to kick out of your finish before we go home. I told him that in the ring. So I got him to calm down, and we got through it. You know, he would hit the ropes in the wrong direction and run the wrong way, and I was used to that.
Yeah.
And the match was okay, you know, but the fact that he blew up so fast was hard because he really couldn't press me over his head.
You're a big dude.
And you know, it turned out good, but I didn't have a problem putting him over. But when I asked why are we doing this or where are we going next, I didn't get the answer I wanted. So I kind of had a hard on from that point on, you know.
One of the things I've always really appreciated about you was, and it comes with anybody that's lasted a long time, but you were on top for a super long time and drawing huge money, taking care of yourself, because you got to take care of yourself.
Yeah. But what a lot of people don't understand is you have to take care of the other guy more than yourself. And what a lot of people don't realize about this business, and there's just two quick points I'm going to say is, first off, this business was a little tough for me when I went to New York when I beat the Sheik, because to me, it was a shoot and this business was not a work. Anytime a man makes, like if I wrestle you and you make more money than me, that's a shoot. I want your spot. And when I went back to work in 84, Vince Sr. always paid the champion more money. And that was a shoot to me. You know, if we're all doing jobs and it doesn't matter if you win or lose, we make the same amount of money. It's a work. But when someone's making more money, to me, that's a shoot. So when I went back and Vince took over, I tried to hold him to that as long as I could, that the champion always makes more money. So that was one of the things, you know, that I fought for. The other thing that I fought for on top of that, which I lost that battle eventually, then I hung on for a long time. The other thing I fought for was making sure whoever I worked with, whether they beat me or whether it was a DQ or they did a job, they were worth more money going out than they were going in. And one of the things to keep myself alive in that Warrior, like I had to go to people like the One Man Gang. And what people don't realize is when I was working with Vince, if I went to the Philadelphia Spectrum and I said, hey, Roddy, Vince wants to beat you with a leg drop, or hey, Orndorff, Vince wants me to do the leg drop, they said, I'm not doing a fucking job today. Well, there was no control like it is now. I'd call Vince back. Say, hey, Vince, I know you want me to beat Piper, but he doesn't want to do a job today. Well, goddamn it, you know, work it out. I said, okay. So it was a wild, wild west back then. So I had to sit down with these guys and on a camaraderie level and get along with them. And if they didn't want to put me over, I said, well, what else can we do to make this work? And the last thing I want is someone else coming in here and taking your place and making this main event money, because we were going to come back for 2 and 3. So since you don't want to do that finish, what can we do to make this work? And thought back at them. So that you don't want to put me over, you don't want to DQ. Sometimes the Hulk Hogan thing, I hate to say this, but the Hulk Mania thing was over so strong, I could beat you, and as I was posing, if you'd come back and ground me, I'd get some color, we'd sell out again, just for you jumping me after the fact. So I would always throw it back at these guys with the finishes that didn't want to do jobs for me. Piper never did a job for me. And years later, we became good friends, and I stuck it up his ass going, can you imagine how much money you'd have made, Piper, if I could have trusted you to flip the belt like Macho? And he'd go, and Piper, and God damn it, you know how he'd get. But I would always tease Piper later on in life because he would never put me over. I said, if you'd put me over, can you imagine? I could have kept putting the belt on you four or five times, flipping it back and forth. And I was doing movies. You were doing movies, but you never get the belt because you wouldn't do a job. So I always would take care of the guys. So when I was doing the Warrior thing and he wanted to go home early, I had to take care of myself because I'm putting him over. And one of the things I really needed was to kick out of his finish to show that I'm still Hulk Hogan. Yep. And then when you beat me, you're really beating a bigger monster because I've kicked out of your finish. You know, and then you come back and beat me. It's going to be good for you, but it helps me too. So my whole mindset the whole time I worked with plan A, plan B, or plan C, like I talked about, the Hulk Hogan finishes, were to protect my opponents so I could come back and draw money with them. I'd go like to the Garden with Randy Savage three, four times in a row and sell the place out three, four times in a row just with Randy because he would do the right finishes with me. You know, so it worked.
But tell me about getting that news going back 10, 15 minutes. You talk about Vince Jr. saying, hey, man, I'm not seeing the red and yellow, man. Maybe you know, it's time to shift gears. And, of course, that was pre-Warrior match when you dropped the title to him. He was IC champ. You were the world champ. So he's in there celebrating with his belt. I agree. You want to take care of the other guy. It's great for him to come out better than he was before the match, you know, before he entered the match. But you have to take care of yourself first. And you have. Come on, man.
I know that. But the thing was, and I hate this sounds like a total ego trip, but, bro, that Hulkamania thing got over so strong, I didn't have to worry about that. I just need somebody to dance with.
Oh, I know. But had you just gone out and laid down for everybody, it wouldn't have worked.
No, it'd have been, dead, yeah.
But, yeah. But anyway, my point is, all of a sudden, you guys have this match. You reel him back in. It is what it is.
Yeah.
There's a couple things in there he roughed up, but you maintain your composure, bam. Come through with a stellar match. Crowd's going crazy. I mean, I think they would have popped louder had you won, but they popped for him. You know, it was nice. The thing that stuck out to me was you kicked out at about 3 1/8, 3 1/4.
Yeah.
I love that because you were there for the three count, but as soon as that referee's hand hit for that, I guess it was Dave.
Yeah.
You kicked out.
Yeah.
And to me, it goes back to old Japan fighting spirit. Yeah. And boy, he beat him, but he barely beat him.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between kicking out at 3/4 and laying there like a dead sack of shit and just saying flat backed 1, 2, 3 and just remain motionless. It kept you alive. And then all of a sudden you're just overcome with disappointment. You look up.
Yeah.
And, dude, you saved yourself. You put the man over to the highest level. You dropped the belt to him in a WrestleMania, but you kept yourself over. Then you walked out.
Yeah.
You did the turnaround, and instead of gaffing him and turning heel, you handed him the world championship. You hug him, and you put him over. But to me, that solidified you as still being the man.
Well, that was all. And this is... I guess this is the evil Hulk coming out, which I try not to be, but that was all calculated because Hebner was supposed to hand in the belt, and I knew if I slid out there and grabbed that belt, and I walked up on the apron on the outside and looked at that belt and looked up at the big man and went, yeah, okay. Then I walked in the ring, and when I handed the Warrior the belt, he's the one that charged me for the hug and said, I love you, and so I went with it. Perfect. Now when I leave, and I say, this is the guy. When I leave, I was betting on the people following me going down that aisle. And that's what I was going to give Vince the hard time about. Because if you watch that back, when he goes up to celebrate and I step out of the ring and walk down the aisle, every person in that building is looking down the aisle and watching me. They're not watching him celebrate in the ring. That's when I wanted to turn around. You know, I did it for the money. I wanted to gaff him. I was dying to turn heel. I knew I'd have been white hot, but Vince had a different opinion.
But I just loved to me when you walked off, well, and to almost the point of you still being the man, you headlined the next year's WrestleMania.
Yeah.
Against Sergeant Slaughter. And he was before that. It didn't last.
We had A, B, and C towns. Vince was running three towns a night. And God, this is hard. I don't even know how to say that. Every time I say this, it sounds terrible. But you can ask the boys to look at their booking sheet to see whose town they're on, Hogan's or Warriors. And
dude, it is what it is. Okay, the numbers ain't lying. Yeah, yeah, you're going to tell
them.
I
get so much heat on myself when I talk about this shit, so here we go again. So if most of the guys look to see if they're on my fucking towns, because if they're on my towns, they made more money. That's just the way it was. And I didn't need the belt. The gimmick was over. Just like you didn't need the belt. The gimmick was over. They sent him off in a direction with the belt with Randy, and they were coming back to me saying, you know, you got to take the belt back. And I didn't want to say I told you so, but if you let me turn heel, I could have really got this guy over. But I needed a couple months to get him over, but they wouldn't let me do that because I'm all about getting you or the Warrior up so I can make that paper, bro. That's my deal. And I'm only in this business for one reason. I love it, and I love making the money. Okay, I hate the travel, and I hate all the bullshit. But I just love being in the ring. I love the money, you know, and I just love the business. And so that's what I was trying to do. But, you know, it just didn't pan out that way.
Hey, man, let me just start shooting from the hip here because I just want to sit there and hang out and drink a few beverages with you and get off microphone. How was it working with Randy Savage?
If I've ever been in love with another guy, it would have been Randy. That son of a bitch was my best friend. I mean, Brutus was like hanging out, but Brutus was kind of like a lost puppy. I was friends with his sister in high school. Brutus was a few years behind, so when we'd go to the beach in the morning, we'd tell Brutus we're leaving at 10, you know, and we'd leave at 8 o'clock, and we would just leave him behind. He was too young to hang out with us. He got in the wrestling business, and it was just kind of like a thing where he was a lost puppy and a friend. He kind of hung around, and it was just surface-level stuff, but Randy and I became really good friends. And he was just intense. He was kind of like David Schultz, man. He was just like so intense. He'd call me up at 3 and go, hey, Hogan, man, I don't like that finish. You know, I thought about pulling Elizabeth. Now I think you're right. No, maybe I'm right. I just don't know, but let's talk. He'd call me at 3 in the morning. The only other people that call me at 3 in the morning about wrestling would be Vince. And I love that shit, right?
Yeah.
Because that was my whole life. So Randy lived right down the beach. We were together every day. We worked out of my house every day. We'd charter planes and fly out or go commercial, but we traveled together everywhere. And in the ring, he was so intense. And I like working kind of loose, you know, and making things real easy. And when I grab a headlock on my ground, I'm standing up. We're both breathing and talking and taking it nice and easy. But Randy was so intense, man. When he'd pull on my bald head, he'd rip my hair out. And when he'd punch me, I'd go, God damn it, Randy, any more of those? And you're going to get one. But I love working with him because he loved the business so much. And he was so passionate about it. I'd never been around anybody who was that big of a freak about 24/7 loving this business. So I had great times, great matches with him. Then we had a falling out. Thank God we made up before he passed away, you know, and I miss him to this day.
I only got a chance to barely meet him. I did a job for him at the Orlando TV tapings when we started filming down there way back in the day. Of course, I was a huge Savage fan, just like everybody else was. I wanted to work a program with him. But at the time, you know, the powers that be, I was just that guy. But my question to you is, because I've heard Dallas Page talk about him and, you know, they had a couple of good matches together, but you're traveling with him. You're one of his best friends. Did the guy ever relax? Because even some of the old interviews I used to see him on YouTube, I don't know if he was talking about you or not, but I mean, he's so high strung. Did the guy ever relax?
Mm-mm.
That's who he was.
He never relaxed. He was... And maybe this isn't the word, but he was so paranoid. Because when he first came to Poughkeepsie, Vince said, hey, you know, peek out the curtain, look at this guy, think you can draw money with him? And I saw Randy walk in, and he had a pair of jeans on with patches on. He was trying to be the Macho Man. He had just a little headband like this, leopard skin headband. His hair was hanging out with shades, and he didn't really have his wardrobe thing together. And I said, who's the girl? And Vince goes, oh, that's his wife. I said, well, if the girl's with him, I definitely can make this work. I just really didn't know about him, but when I saw the girl with him, you know, and I knew from Ron Fuller and some of the guys up in Knoxville when Randy's dad was running opposition, they said Randy was real intense and a pretty good worker and just all kind of stuff. And I'd seen him in Memphis a couple of matches, and I knew I could work with him, but if I had the girl, I knew we could really, you know, have a lot of liberty with the finishes and stuff like that. So when I first met Randy, one of the first things I did was I took him to the guy that made all the clothes for Jimi Hendrix and my rock and roll band, this guy named Michael LeBron. And Randy was real paranoid. Well, is this a setup? Why are you got me dressing up like this? He was really freaked out that the tassels and the stuff was a rib on him.
Shoot.
Yeah, he thought it was a rib, but then he realized it was... not a rib. I mean,
showbiz.
Yeah. He got it. And man, he was the best at everything. I love working with him. You know, he was just so much fun in the ring. He's real intense. You know, the only really bitch we had was Paris, France one night. We had shot an angle where Elizabeth was my manager. And when we went to the ring in Paris, there were no steps. Elizabeth was probably 95 or 100 pounds soaking wet. So I reached over the top rope, reached all the way over where she was standing next to the apron and grabbed her by the armpits, picked her all the way up over. She had a dress on, picked her all the way up the ring, and I put her in the ring because there were no steps. You son of a bitch, you grabbed her boobs. I'm going, Randy, what are you going? Fuck you, you motherfucker. I'm going to beat your ass. I'm going, Randy, come on. We lock up. He grabs a headlock on me, but he puts that shoot fucking side headlock on me.
Yeah.
I'm hanging in there, and I didn't want my ball to pop out, so I grabbed his waist, and I hooked him like a shoot, and I squeezed him. I said, Randy, if you don't let go, I'm going to dump you on your head. Now loosen up, bro. I did not grab Elizabeth's tits, you know? He was so pissed at me. The match sucked. We had a horrible match. I was so fucking mad. We went back to the dressing room in Paris. I walked in. I said, Randy, we need to talk right now. Now, I'm not a tough guy, but I was mad. I reached to open the door, and when I pulled the door, I ripped it off the hinges. The door was so old and so rotted by termites, where it was screwed in, you know? It looked like I pulled a Lou Ferrigno, you know, and ripped the door. But the truth was, the door was barely hanging on there. So I ripped the door off, and all the boys were like, whoa, they popped, you know?
Yeah.
So me and Randy went in the back, and... Hey, man, I'm sorry I got mad. I said, Randy, I'm sorry, too. I didn't mean to touch her inappropriately, but there were no steps. We talked about it, but I think the door was the thing that kind of cooled everything down, you know. But it was hanging on by a thread, and when I pulled it, I was just lucky, you know. It helped my bluff a little bit, you know.
I want to come back to Randy about a big-time match when you wrestled Andre at WrestleMania 3, but the other thing, if it's not too far out of line, you said you had an Ultimate Warrior story.
You know, we'd had... a situation with a Warrior where, oh my gosh, it goes way back to where he quit on Vince one time. And then he came back to the Garden. Oh my gosh. He came back to the Garden and I was in a tag match. And Vince came to me and said, hey man, the Ultimate Warrior is putting a gun in my head. He wants a couple hundred grand before I go to the ring. And so I said, well, shoot, Vince, we'll get him in there. You want? We'll break his legs. And Vince goes, oh my God, don't do that. Don't do that. Well, somehow or another, it ended up on videotape that in the self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior, somehow or another, I can't remember if I relayed the story or who filmed it or whatever it was, but at a deposition, they asked me if I said that. I said, well, I don't remember it. And then they played the tape, and I had said it. So maybe I'd ran my mouth to somebody, but it was on tape. So we had a little bit of a run in there, but he went ahead and wrestled, and, you know, Vince did what he had to do to make it work, and then, you know, pulled away, you know what I'm saying? But anyway, it all worked out fine. And then... the Warrior quit again, and all of a sudden he started doing all these videos on YouTube about coming to my house and stuff that I tried to do and my ex-wife tried to do, hitting on him and all this insane stuff. And he was staying at my house and staying in my guest room, and I had a Hawker. We were flying around on my plane going to the towns, and he was playing with my kids and stuff, and all these weird things came up on YouTube about stuff that I'd done and stuff with Kevin Nash, and just all weird stuff was coming up. So he was getting some heat on himself. And when we went to WrestleMania 30, all the boys were staying in the hotel, but the Warrior was staying at a house on the outside of town somewhere. And Vince told me, he goes, when you go to the Hall of Fame and you go to, and I was sitting next to you with Jennifer that night. When we go to the Hall of Fame, I don't know why they put me right in front of him. When you go to the Hall of Fame or you go to WrestleMania, or Monday Night Raw, we do not want you talking to the Warrior, saying anything about him. We're going to fly you guys to Connecticut and have a sit-down after we get through the weekend. But sure enough, we go to the Hall of Fame, and I'm sitting right in front of him. You probably don't remember it. There was one little jab thrown out, and I just sat there, and I didn't say anything. There was one little jab thrown out. I let it go. Really wanted to roll right up on that stage, but I let it go. And then the next night at WrestleMania, we were in that damn Superdome from noon on. And me and my son Nick got bored. So Nick goes, hey, Dad, there's a golf cart there. I said, well, is it key? And Nick goes, yeah, well, let's go ride around. And that's such a long ride, you know, that all of a sudden as we're riding around, it must be a mile around the place, it felt like. All of a sudden, we're driving to go back to where we were about halfway around the place, and I see this guy in a suit, and his back is to us, and he's wobbling, and he's rocking like this. And as we rode by, I looked at him, and I went, stop, Nick, stop. It was the Ultimate Warrior. I jumped out of the car. And I, at the time, I could kind of jog a little bit. I kind of jogged back to him. I was so excited to see him. And I went, hey, Jim. And he opened his eyes. He goes, no. He went, no. I said, no, brother, I'm cool. I love you, man. I'm cool. So I went, and I had no idea they had a camera on him at the time. WWE had one of those handhelds watching. He's drenched in sweat. And we had a talk, and I said, brother, first thing I want to do is just apologize for whatever I did. I want to apologize. I really, I'm sorry, for whatever I did to piss you off. And, I just want to be friends with you, this and that and the other. And we shook hands. He goes, oh, God damn it, Hulk. Well, what am I going to tell all my fans that have stuck with me? I said, well, what you were telling them wasn't true. I don't know what you're going to tell them, but what was being said wasn't true about me and my wife and all this other stuff. I said, but I just want to be friends with you, and, could we possibly start over? He goes, oh, damn it, Hulk, Yeah, I really want to start over. It's all on tape. WWE filmed us. So we shook hands. We told each other we loved each other. And, then I went back to Vince, and I said, Vince, I know you're going to be pissed, but I accidentally ran into him. Accidentally on purpose. When I saw him, I jumped out to talk to him. And I said, Vince, it's okay. Don't worry. We're cool. We loved each other, shook hands, said we loved each other. Everything's good. One thing led to another. We do the WrestleMania, and then we do the Monday Night Raw, and I'm sitting next to Vince with him out there putting a little mask on. He's turning grass at Vince. Get the camera off him. Something's wrong. He doesn't look right, And when he got out of the thing, and he's drenched in sweat again, he comes to the back, and me, Warrior, and Patterson take a picture, and then the next day he passed away. But that whole thing was when I went to the Warrior and I said, I'm sorry. And we talked for a few minutes. He said he forgave me. And he says, hey, brother, it's all right, man. I love you too. Well, then after that, some other people in his family kind of like said some other stuff. But all I'm going on is what he said to me, not what other people in his family might have said, but because there's some other people in his family that still don't like me, but that's okay. All I care about is what he said to me. And the last thing that he said to me was that he forgave me. I was glad that I got to see him, too, before he passed away.
One of the things I was talking about earlier, and I'm trying to wrap this podcast up, and God dang, I could talk to you all day, but I just want to shoot the breeze with you. We talked about your salesmanship in the ring. You would just sell your ass off, and man, here comes the fire, and making that comeback. But one of the things you did was the Hulk up. And to me, if not done properly, if not 120% committed to, could be conceived. If you watch it without sound, it could almost be comical.
Yeah.
But you were committed, and Hulkamania was running wild, and that comeback, that commitment still holds up today. I was watching it last night. My question to you is, how did you come up with that? And you got to be all in, mister, and you were. Talk to me about that.
Well, I watched... Growing up, I watched Bobo Brazil when he'd come to Tampa, when he'd take that turnbuckle and not sell it, I actually watched certain people in Tampa, they'd get suplexed and they'd stand up at the same time as the guy that suplexed him. And for some reason, even though it didn't make any sense and it wasn't rational, it worked, And so part of the whole thing was the Lou Ferrigno character, where his clothes would rip off him where he'd hulk up. That kind of like started one night in Chicago when Greg and Jim ripped a shirt off me when I was standing there, and they just ripped my shirt off me for no reason. When they announced my name, I went, holy smokes, that worked. So right away I stole that. But that whole selling thing, when people would come up out of a rear chin lock and they'd start coming up and the crowd would get with them and then they'd get cut off. Sometimes they'd get cut off because it wasn't time for the comeback. And sometimes the heel would cut them off and totally screw up that moment that you can't get back again. But the commitment I made kind of like came out of, I saw Dusty Rhodes one time do the finger, okay? So I'm like, he doesn't do that all the time, so let me steal that, And then one time in the ring, I saw Austin Idol do the ear thing down in Mobile, Alabama. I went, that works, but he's on a small stage. Nobody sees that, so let me take that up to New York and steal that. And then there's this whole Beatlemania thing going on. And then one time I heard Austin Idol say Idolmania. And I went, he's on a small stage down here in Memphis. Let me steal that. So I kind of like took some of the things that I'd saw. But once I realized somebody puts that rear chin lock up on you, you put the finger up, you go one, two, three. After they drop your hand twice and the third time, da, da, da. When you come up, you can't go back down. And so once I started coming up, I just would never let anybody stop me. You know what I mean? Even if they gut shot at me or punched me or whatever.
It was no sell.
No. Once I came up, it was a total commitment. And what you, like you said, if you do watch it without sound, it looks hokey and comical as hell. But when you hear that arena.
Yes.
and you start hulking up and you hulk. And it took me a while. It took me a while before I'd take one punch, I'd look at the guy. The second punch, I'd start shaking. The third punch, I'd come up off the knee and walk the circle. And then the fourth punch, I'd stop and you. But it took me a while to figure that out. Yeah. A lot of times I'd stumble around the ring in a circle and they'd go to hit me. Next time I just start the comeback. So it took me a while to even figure out you. And I tell the heels, I'm pointing at you. You don't want any of this. Just back up, and then throw the punch.
Yep.
Block it. 1, 2, 3, big foot. We go home. But it took a while to get that. But it always worked. It made no sense. It was comical as hell. But boy, if you were in that arena, the people bought it and they believed it. But it was like you said, it was 100% commitment. Once you started, you couldn't back off. Otherwise, you'd look like a goof.
I ain't gonna lie to you. I was sitting there watching Terry hulk up and go through and talk me through this. I got mesmerized and lost my train of thought and forgot my question. So I'm gonna continue on with another question before we go home. We talked about that comeback. We talked about the salesmanship. Who gave you the big boot, drop the leg? Or how did you come up with that, the big boot, drop the leg, after the patented comeback?
Well, when I first broke in the business, everything was like an Oklahoma roll-up or sunset flip or some type of octopus submission hold or something like that. But it just didn't work for the character. Over in Japan, you know, for some reason, after I teamed up with Stan Hansen, they called the clothesline that I did Axie Boomba, you know. And the only thing different between me and Stan was Stan would throw somebody in the ropes and take their head off. I'd throw them in the ropes, and I'd go back and hit the other ropes and meet them dead center of the ring. So for some reason, nobody was using the leg drop, you know. But I really screwed up because people always ask me if there's any one thing you could have changed in the wrestling business, would you go back and change anything? And at this point, I would say yes, my finish. Because when you walk around telling everybody, you've got the largest arms in the world, why wouldn't you use the sleeper? In, out of it, work the hell out of it, you know, all kind of stuff. But the leg drop, the big boot, I kind of like stole from Andre because I loved when he hit people with that boot real high. So I kind of hit people with a boot, and the leg drop just seemed like the natural thing to do. You know, and nobody else was doing it. I mean, everybody in the world has their finish. Back then it was hard. We weren't as innovative or as athletic as some of these kids that can do the triple somersault, these balancing acts and all this stuff that they do. But no one was using the leg drop. So that seemed like the way to go.
The next time we cross paths, I want to go back to, I guess it was 96 when you went back down to WCW and then you joined or started the New World Order along with the Outsiders. So there's a whole bunch more years to talk about. But my last question is, any advice or what advice would you give someone today that aspires to be or is trying to get in the business or is in the business and trying to get over? Because what do you think the keys were? I mean, dude, there's so many things on you. The litmus test is just for the eyeball test, the charisma, the rap, the ability. So you had a lot of things going for you. But if you're trying to tell somebody how to get over, what would you say to them? Because I think everybody gets over in a different way based on the physical and mental abilities or capabilities they bring to the squared circle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. You know, we got the standard bearer of the WWE, and it's just such a different. It's almost like going out and catching a big grouper out here when you go fishing or catching a sea bass or something like that or a sailfish. You're out in the wild. Every fish has a different personality. When you reel it in, you're in for a different fight as compared to going. So like a buddy of mine, Steve Cardillo, just sent me 12 lobsters from a lobster farm.
The guy that makes the belts.
Yeah, right. And so usually when we go get lobsters, we dive for them down in Key West, and we pull them out of holes and cracks, and we're catching these wild lobsters. They're all different shapes and sizes. But all of a sudden, I get these 12 lobsters. They're all 2 pounds. They look exactly the same. So back in the day when you're getting over, you had a chance to go out and, you know, in the wild, wild west, whoever was the quickest drawer, if you could learn from Stolen Cold or David Schultz or Ox Baker, you'd learn stuff as you're out picking stuff up. And everybody was different shapes and sizes, and they'd have a different read on how to get over. Nowadays, the standard bearer, you've got a bunch of people coming out of the same facility, being trained by the same exact people, learning how to hit the ropes the same way with the same drop down high spot, and there's a certain way to roll and do that and the other. So I'm not saying they're all the same, but it's really hard for a person to develop how to get over when you're you know, coming out of the same environment. Like those 12 lobsters were all the same people who were getting trained the same by the same trainers. I don't know if these trainers are main event trainers, if they're preliminary guys or just technicians or guys that come in from not the wrestling world and train these people. I really don't know who's training them down there. But instead of getting over it, almost you almost got to get in the business and get by all that and get on the big stage. Well, before I had a chance to figure out how to get over before I got on the big stage. Now you get put on the big stage, and then when you're there, you better figure out how to get over. And they feed you the content as far as creative. Most of the time they feed you the verbiage. So somewhere in between all this, someone has to shoot the gap somewhere and figure out what really separates you and will get you over from just the other person that was trained the same way as you, that's getting handed the same version by the same guy that wrote the same thing for the other five wrestlers. So somewhere in between that stuff, there has to be instinct. You know, you have to have some type of instinct to sniff out that edge, you know. So a lot of guys go out there, like when I saw Kevin Owens, I saw him in NXT, and I watched two of his matches, and I watched him really grind. I watched him really chop meat, and I went, okay, there's a brother right there that's got heat. Everybody I talked to at the WWE wasn't real, real high on him like I was at the time. You know, the look, a lot of things, you know, that he didn't have going for him, they kind of pointed out. But I said, no, I'm telling you, you give this guy a chance to get over, he'll chop meat, and he'll grind, and this and that and the other. And so I was kind of like betting on the farm, and I didn't even know Kevin. I just ran my mouth and I said, you know, there's a guy in NXT that I saw then, so I think he could really get over. And back in the Wild Wild West days, it would have been a different story. And even with the way they set things up and everything was like a cadence, or this is how it works, then we go from here to here to here in Monday Night Raw, he still got over. He found that spot in between the cadence to shoot his angle and get himself over. So it's really hard. You got to have a... You know, the first thing is to get by the rigmarole to get in the business. And then once you're in the business, you need to have all your feelers out. And you got to find that spot somewhere in the middle of what they want you to do and what is a little different that can change it. And then once I found out, if you got balls enough to shoot your own angle out there, they want you to grab that brass ring and one run with it. Because they may tell Stone Cold what they want, but once you get out there, whether it's shooting the bird or the beer or this and that and the other, you can shoot your own angle and take a chance and get over. You know, that's how I would tell them. If you got a gut instinct for something and you think it might work, don't tell anybody, but go out there and try it.
I agree. I won't get into the it factor or the X factor, because I think some people are born with it and some people can be born with a little bit of it, but I also think it can be learned. You know, guys with extreme gimmicks, they thought of them, they're just normal people. Not everybody is just super charismatic, but there is that it factor that has turned them into a draw. That's a whole other conversation. Last question. I just read, and we can not put this on the podcast if you don't want to, but I heard that they were going to make a movie, a biopic or whatever, a movie about your life, and Chris Hemsworth was going to play the part of Hulk Hogan.
Right.
Is this true, and how's this going about? Are you a part of it?
Yeah, I am a part of it. It was it was something that Eric Bischoff and I started working on about 6 or 7 years ago, and you know, Eric approached me with it, and I said, oh, let's give it a shot. And he had a couple little writers that worked for Imagine Studios and Ron Howard that Eric sent down here. And I talked and told them the Hulk Hogan story, and they kind of like wrote the script and stuff. And I gave it to WWE first, and they passed on it 7 years ago. And then the script kind of flopped around, and there was a development time, you know, that they had a certain amount of time, 6 months or something, to sell it. When they didn't, I told Eric, no big deal, it's extended, do what you need to do. It went away for a while, and then a couple of years ago, Eric said, hey man, would you care if I tried to resurrect this thing? And I said, no man, go for it. So all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this Todd Phillips guy that does the Hangover movies and War Dogs and Wolf of Wall Street and all these things, he called me up. He goes, hey man, I'm a big wrestling fan, I'd like to come down here and talk to you. So he flew down here, and we had a meeting at the San Pro Hotel over here. And he goes, I really think this could be a huge movie. And Chris Hemsworth is a huge fan, and he's never played a real person before. He thinks he can win an Academy Award playing you. And I'm like, wait a minute, hold on. I've done no holds barred a wrestling movie. I've done a bunch of low budget movies. I saw The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, and he did a great job, you know, kind of close, but no cigar. And I know a couple guys that may be where he's at, but to win an Academy Award for a Hulk Hogan movie, I just thought of it. It's a goof wrestling movie. Well, you know, I kind of saw the trailer for Joker, which Todd Phillips just finished. And when the Joker's coming out, Joaquin Phoenix, he's walking down the hall, the way they shot it, it looks like Jurassic Park with dinosaurs. And when I saw it, I went, oh my God, that's how big of a movie they want to make. I went ahead and signed the deal with them, and Todd Phillips is on board. The star, Chris Hemsworth, is on board. And most of the time, you don't have that when you go to like Netflix or somewhere. And so they went to Netflix, and they've got the budget and everything like that already for the movie. We've been working with this guy, Scott Silver, who wrote 8 Mile and a bunch of other things. He took the script that me and Eric did, and he said, this is a real piece of shit. And he rewrote it, you know. And that's what he's doing now. And so... we got the budget, we got the main actor, we got some major characters that may play the heels, but they want to see the script first. But it's just getting it green lit. And, you know, we got high hopes because you usually don't go to a production company with a producer like that and the actor already on board without a script. So we're going to see what happens.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing in town is to get something green lit. But like you said, to roll in with the director and the main guy attached, that should pull some weight. Last but not least, where can people find you on social media? And is there anything else you'd like to plug? Do you have an upcoming appearance? Anything that you'd like to promote on a podcast? Give the people some 411. And I thank you for your time. And I know I'm going to hang out with you a little bit longer, but we got to do this because we got to do part two. There's no way to cover your career or all the hijinks, headaches, hassles, and horseshit in a couple hours. So we've got more to come. But tell people where they can find you or what you're up to.
Well, I'm the worst guy in the world as far as social media. I got a kid named Ron Howard, not the actor. I call him the almost famous Ron Howard, who runs my little beat shops, Hogan's Beat Shops. And he's got me on, what do you call this thing? Twitter? No, not Twitter. On Instagram. I think it's at Hulk Hogan. I'm on Twitter, too. I don't know what that is.
You're terrible.
And I've got a Facebook, and I'm not sure what that is either. But I got, like, he told me the other day between, I mean, I know it's not a lot of people compared to you or the other guys, but it's, I know I've got about 10 million people between Facebook and Twitter. I don't know if that's good or bad.
Good.
That's good?
Yeah.
And I do the Twitter myself every once in a while, but he handles the Facebook and the Instagram stuff. But other than that, the only thing I got going really is if you're ever here in Florida, over here at Clearwater Beach, I've got a little memorabilia shop called Hogan's Beach Shop, where I've got all kind of wrestling stuff and belts. And then in Orlando, off Sand Lake Road, right across the street from the biggest McDonald's in the world, I've got another Hogan's Beach Shop there. And that's a much bigger one. And it's got a lot of cool stuff in there for the fans. But I'm getting ready to open up a new bar and restaurant. This is my fourth attempt. And this is going to be called Hogan's Hangout right on Clearwater Beach. But other than that, I'm just hanging out, man, and living life. And I'm the biggest wrestling fan in the world. I record and watch everything. And I'm always around somewhere.
Man, it was good spending a day with you. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Let's get some props to our friends over at TrueCar for supporting the podcast from day one. With TrueCar, 60 seconds is all you'll need to get an offer for your car. And the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, and do a few push-ups, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or even from home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in, and they'll check it out with you. Together, you can ask questions and get the answers you need so there's no surprises. Then, simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas. Hey, man, you're going to need some car insurance for that vehicle. Go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at GEICO.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. And I'm fixing to go out to my shop and fiddle with all my damn Kawasaki's and my trucks. I got some brand-new personalized license plates for my 1966 Chevy pickup truck, my C10. I'm looking forward to putting them things on there. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with the one and only Hulk Hogan. I'm telling you, There's not too many guys that knew how to read a crowd and to get sympathy. This is a 300-pound dude that was 6'6", 6'7", in his prime to be able to get sympathy and get those fans behind him so much. The dude was over at a super stupid level, just a gigantic star. He transcended the business and became a hero to so many people. I enjoyed talking to him. I enjoyed hanging out with him. And, you know, he's had his ups and downs, and he's doing well, and he had a great, great run. One of the best, if not the best, runs in the history of the business. Now, him and I both do agree that, in our opinions, Nature Boy Ric Flair is the greatest of all time and the greatest world champion in the history of the business. So that is undisputed in our opinions of who is the greatest of all time. Anyway, don't forget to rate and review the Steve Austin Show on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends to check us out. And if you want to reach me here on the podcast, send an email to questions@steveaustinshow.com. Holy cow, the best damn IPA on planet Earth, Broken Skull IPA from El Segundo Brewing Companies, got lit up when I did my appearance at the Raw Reunion in Tampa, Florida. I closed that show out, started drinking Broken Skull IPAs, and man, I have poured I don't know how many damn light beers down my gullet, closing up and starting off Monday Night Raws and being out there on the road in general to finally go out there. I had iced those beers down for 5 days, and they were super chilled. They were stone cold. It was the best damn beer I've ever poured down my throat. I think they're running short on supply, but they are high in demand. Look for Broken Skull IPA in Southern California. We're trying to get it all over the place. We're trying to expand distribution. Stay tuned, but contact El Segundo Brewing Company if you want to try to find it. But also, we are at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in California. If you're not in Cali, you could be SOL. But it was awesome to drink my cold-ass Broken Skull IPA at that show. Looking for a badass pocket knife? I always suggest everybody have one. I actually gave one of my Broken Skulls to Hulk Hogan because everybody needs a badass pocket knife. Check out the Cold Steel Broken Skull knife and the Working Man's knife at my Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin or go directly to the Cold Steel Knives website and check out all their badass stuff. Hey, I'd like to say thank you one more time to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially TrueCar, Geico, and betonline.ag. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. If you need more info on my sponsors, check out the show description to this episode for details. Folks, next week I have my old buddy Booker T on the podcast. Me and Booker T got our signals crossed. I thought we were going to talk on a Sunday. We ended up talking on Monday, right in the middle of the Raw Reunion, backstage in a dressing room. So stay tuned. Next week, my guest on the show is Booker T. Six-time world champion. I think he's the most decorated guy in the history of WCW wrestling. And he had a hell of a run in WWE. And, of course, the classic supermarket brawl and all that stuff. But don't miss my conversation with Booker T. And if you see me out in the woods, you can sure bet I'll be riding a Kawasaki. Folks, until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.